I'll call the March 12, 2025 meeting of the House Public Safety meeting to order. A quorum is present. If we don't complete our work today by the committee's adjournment time of 4:45, we'll recess and reconvene in this room at 6:15 p.m. today or at the call of the chair. Before beginning our meeting, I want to remind everyone that the committee expects proper decorum at all times. All dialogue goes through the chair. Signs are not allowed in the committee room. There will be no outbursts, clapping, or shouting. There is no standing or sitting in the walkways and aisles. If an accommodation is needed, communicate with the sergeant's staff. There will be consequences if there is a disruption. Thank you to the sergeant at arms staff who are present for helping maintain decorum in the committee room. Representative Moeller, have you had a chance to review the minutes of the March 11th, 2025 meeting?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move their approval.
Representative Moeller moves approval of the March 11th, 2025 minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion carries and the minutes of the March 11th, 2025 meeting are approved. First bill on the agenda today is House File 897. Representative Knutson, please come to the table with your testifier. Representative Knutson, since you are not a member of this committee, I will move House File 897 before the committee with a recommendation to re-refer to House File, to re-refer House File 897 to Family, our Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Knutson, I believe you also have an author's amendment, DE1. I will move your amendment before the committee. Please explain your amendment.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. The DE1 is based off of recommendations from the Minnesota County Attorney Association, and it just adds fentanyl to the title, and then the definition of fentanyl in Chapter 152.137, Subdivision 25.
I believe that was in response to recommendations or requests for clarification from the County Attorneys Association. We have a copy of that letter in the pack for everyone that wants to read that. Representative, any questions on Representative Knutson's amendment, the DE1? All in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Knutson, please explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Novotny and members. House File 897, as amended, aligns the criminal penalty for exposing children and vulnerable adults to fentanyl with current statutes for methamphetamine exposure. Unfortunately, the need for this legislation has been born out of many tragic situations, including the death of an 18-month-old toddler this last Christmas Day. There should be actually, I think, an article in your packets about that situation and another one regarding the death of a three-year-old due to the exposure of fentanyl. I do have some testifiers with me today that would like to further explain the need for this legislation. I'd like to move to that now. Thank you.
See, we have two testifiers at the table. Would the testifiers begin by stating their name and begin their testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sebastian Mesa. I am an assistant county attorney in Aiken County. I came here to support this bill. I wrote to Representative Knutson regarding this proposed legislative action because I've had cases in my county where I've been limited, not able to prosecute them appropriately. As you all know, 152.137 makes it a felony to expose a child or vulnerable adult to methamphetamine, knowingly. And it struck me as rather peculiar that a drug as dangerous as fentanyl, a drug that is far more dangerous than methamphetamine in terms of the amount that is required to cause a person to suffer an overdose, would not fit under that same legislative scheme. Happily, Representative Knudsen and Senator Utke have championed this bill. I think it's significant. Some folks will say, well, overdoses are down, and that is true. Thank God, because of Narcan and the efforts of first responders, we have seen a marked decrease in overdose deaths across the entire state, up from a five-year high with the pandemic. However, fentanyl is still a danger to all our communities in outstate Minnesota, where I am from, and the cities, the metro area. And non-fatal overdoses, and I'm basing this on the data available from the Minnesota Department of Health, non-fatal overdoses involving fentanyl have continued to rise. As far as 2023, which was the last year that I could look at, I don't know if the committee has access to more recent information, but that's on 11% increase. When you remove heroin from the opioid overdoses, you see that that line continues to climb. And that is due to fentanyl, an extremely dangerous drug. The situation that motivated me to come forward was a child that was exposed through crushed fentanyl sitting on a nightstand with a fan aimed at it. And that child and other children had their cribs in that same room. I can't imagine that any of us would sit here and think that is not felony level behavior. It is. And this is not a partisan issue. It is about similarly situated defendants being treated similarly. Fentanyl and methamphetamine are both dangerous drugs, and fentanyl should be considered at least as dangerous, at least as toxic, to children and vulnerable adults as methamphetamine is. And if you consider, well, fentanyl disproportionately affects minority communities, Native American, Black and Brown communities. If you believe that to be true, then I would argue to you that those communities, those children, those vulnerable adults deserve just as much protection as white communities who are more affected by methamphetamine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I yield.
Next testifier looks like Chief Potts. Chief Potts, say your full name and begin your testimony.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Jeff Potts, Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. And I am here today to speak on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association in support of House File 897. To be honest and frank about this issue, fentanyl, opioids in general, and specifically fentanyl, continues to wreak havoc on our state and on our country. Mr. Mesa mentioned there is a decrease in overdose deaths, but let's put that in context that in 2023, there were still 1,338 overdose deaths, 919 of those related to opioids. Now, we've seen some preliminary data for 2024, but we're still talking probably close to 1,000 deaths and perhaps 70, 80, maybe 90% of those could be attributed to fentanyl. And so it's still a major issue. The drug task forces throughout the state continue to see fentanyl on nearly every drug that they seize, whether it be cocaine, methamphetamine, or even pills. It's mixed into these pills, most of which are counterfeit pills. According to the DEA, 6 out of 10 counterfeit pills contain a lethal amount of fentanyl. 6 out of 10. So people may not even know that the pill that they're taking contains, in most cases don't know that it's a lethal amount, they may not even know that it contains fentanyl. And so we believe as an association that this bill will help. Unfortunately, the incidents that the author spoke about, a 3-year-old, an 18-month-old, the case that the previous testifier spoke about is happening far too frequently, where these drugs are in close proximity to kids, children in daycares, children in homes. Our drug task force is seeing this on a regular basis. And again, we want to thank the author for bringing this bill forward. And again, want to say that the Chiefs Association supports this bill. And thank you for allowing me to testify here today.
Thank you, Chief. Last testifier is Paul Ostro from Fentanyl Free Communities. Mr. Ostro, please state your full name and begin your testimony when you're ready.
Thank you so much, and many thanks to Chair Novotny and the author, Representative Knutson, and all the authors of this bill. My name is Paul Ostro, spelled O-S-T-R-O-W. I'm here today in my capacity as Chair of Fentanyl Free Communities, and I'm also a retired prosecutor. I'm hoping that today this is an issue that you can all agree upon, and hopefully everyone here can, if not be an author, can support it regardless of political party. We believe as an organization that of all the issues we face, there is none that demands bipartisanship more than this one. As I mentioned, I am the chair of Fentanyl Free Communities. It is a nonpartisan and a non-ideological organization. We are laser focused on saving lives lost to fentanyl. We are laser focused on education and advocacy. We are a powerful partnership between former elected officials such as myself, public safety leaders, and parents who have lost loved ones to fentanyl. Our goal is to ensure that institutions throughout Minnesota, and specifically the Minnesota legislature, enact best practices and direct resources wherever needed to attack this epidemic. I am a former elected official. I served as Minneapolis City Council President 20 years ago in a different era. But more importantly for today's discussion, I am a career prosecutor who was the chief narcotics trafficking prosecutor in Anoka County for the last decade of my career. I saw firsthand the toll of fentanyl on our communities. I prosecuted fentanyl dealers, and I worked with the families of victims whose children were poisoned by fentanyl. In January of this year, our policy committee developed our legislative agenda, which was approved by our board of directors. One of the priority issues on our agenda is, to quote, heightened criminal penalties for parents or caretakers of juveniles who expose children to fentanyl. Our full agenda will be available on our website, fentanylfreecommunities.org, by early next week. And I must add that we are ready to partner with any legislators and assist in garnering support for any legislation that will save lives in Minnesota. This legislation, frankly, is a complete no-brainer. I've successfully prosecuted individuals under the existing statute, including a case that went to the Court of Appeals. But let's get real, as the other testifiers in the Aiken County attorney mentioned. While exposure to methamphetamine by a child is certainly harmful and dangerous and life-threatening, exposure to fentanyl is a likely death sentence for many juveniles. There is simply no logical argument for protecting children from exposure to methamphetamine while failing to protect children from fentanyl. The problem is growing exponentially. According to the United States Poison Center, and we do consider fentanyl a poison, infant exposure to fentanyl increased by 449% between 2020 and 2023. Think about that for a moment. 2 milligrams of fentanyl can kill an adult. How much fentanyl do you think can kill a newborn or an infant? And consider, even a tiny portion of a pill or a trace amount of cocaine or methamphetamine with fentanyl in it could kill an infant or a child. Fentanyl-Free Communities is a strong proponent of treatment, police-initiated diversion and deflection, and harm reduction through the widespread availability of Narcan. We are an all-hands-on-deck organization. But there must also be a place in society and for this legislature to state unequivocally that if you endanger the life of a precious child or infant through the possession and exposure of fentanyl, there will be criminal consequences. The protection of those unable to protect themselves must continue to be a fundamental value of our state. Thanks again for the opportunity to address you, and again, thanks so much to the author.
Thank you. There being no other signed up testifiers, members, do you have any questions? We'll start with Lead Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Knutson, for bringing this bill. I do support it. We are planning on supporting it today. It kind of got the feeling from the testifiers that there was this idea that maybe we weren't going to support it, but we are. I do have a question, though, for you, and actually got this idea when I was looking at the bill that was pulled from the agenda today. And thinking about this, there are legal uses of fentanyl for medical purposes. I believe they're prescribed after surgeries, for cancer treatments, things like that, which of course children and vulnerable adults could get for a valid purpose. And so I would love to see some sort of exception perhaps carved into your bill that makes it clear that if it's used or prescribed by a medical professional or distributed by a pharmacist, for example, that they wouldn't fall under this bill. And I'm just wondering if you'd be receptive to an amendment like that.
Representative Knutson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Yes, we can talk about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Lee Mueller.
Yep, thank you. And I'll just say that bill that Representative Reimer had that was pulled, House File 1446, had an exception, and that may be a good place to start. I don't know if that's the exact language, but anyway, I thought that was nice that they had put that exception into that bill. Like I said, we plan on supporting this bill. I'll just remind the committee that we worked with Representative Baker over the last few years to increase penalties and modernize our statutes with respect to fentanyl while also recognizing the public health crisis that it is, making sure that our first responders have opioid antagonists on them. We made sure that all schools also have Narcan and other opioid antagonists, which is so important, and we understand that it's been saving lives having that. Recognizing that this is a public health crisis. Again, we're going to support this. A lot of the things that you were saying as you were talking also made me think about firearm storage and how it's too unfortunate we can't get that across the finish line in a bipartisan support, since guns are the leading cause of death of children and adolescents in this country. But be that as it may, we support things that protect the lives of children and are happy to vote yes on this. Thank you.
And can I just say I really appreciate your leadership and the bipartisan leadership on the bills that you referenced.
Anyone else? I will renew my motion to recommend. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Closing. Oh, I'm sorry. No. Close your remarks, recommend Representative
sure.
Knutson.
I'll keep it short. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee, for letting us hear this bill. It really is about protecting children and vulnerable adults, and this is a big gap we have right now. So thank you for the bipartisan support, and hopefully we can get this across the finish line. So, thank you.
And with that, I will renew my motion to recommend that House File 897 is re-referred to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion carries and House 897 is re-referred to Children and Families. Thank you, Representative Knutson, and your testifier. The next bill on the agenda is House File 772. Chair Swazinski, please come to the table with your Chair Swazinski, since you are not a member of this committee, I will move the file 772 before the committee with a recommendation that the bill is re-referred to Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. Chair Swazinski, I believe that you have an author's amendment, A1, and I will move your amendment before the committee. Please explain your amendment.
Yes, the House File 772 A1 amendment, simply on page 1, line 16, deletes undocumented, does the same on page 2, lines 5 and through 15, eliminates the word undocumented. And then on line 1.16, if you look at the bill, it gets rid of a suspected undocumented person and inserts a certain non-citizens are. That's what the amendment does. It cleans it up a little bit to just get around the language and kind of get it in the shape that we'd like it to get. So thank you.
Thank you. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, we'll move on to the vote. All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Chair Swazinski, please explain your bill as amended.
Yes, thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you, members of the committee. House File 772 is, first and foremost, it's an update to current, it updates current law that requires the Department of Corrections and civil commitments to report to ICE when it appears an alien has been committed to their facilities. This original bill was actually passed in 1927, so just a hair under 100 years old. The last time this law was updated was in 2002, where some minor changes were made to it. And if you look at the language, the base language, the state law only refers to two state correctional facilities, because in 1927 there were only two state facilities, the one in St. Cloud and the one in Stillwater. And since that time, we have a total of 11 facilities in our state, and so it brings that up to where it needs to be. Current law also references persons convicted of a felony or who is mentally ill. House File 772 separates these offenses from persons of civility committed to into a different section of law. So it essentially gets them out of the same area and moves them into two different areas of statute. And one of the main reasons this bill is before you is because we just don't actually know if state and local correctional facilities are just complying with current state law. House File 772 requires them to verify compliance. You know, our state correctional facilities, from our conversations with them, are doing this and are actively working with this. But some of the questions that we do have is on the local level, whether or not these things are taking place. And then finally, just a re-hindrance of the A1 amendment kind of cleans up some of the language that may be a bit out of date. And so, you know, that's what the bill does. And I appreciate any questions you may have. I do not have testifiers, but if someone from the public is wanting to come up, we've got plenty of room up here.
We do have two testifiers signed up. Julia Decker, Policy Director, Immigrant Law Center of Minneapolis, and Elder Castillo, Immigration Policy Attorney, Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Ms. Decker, please keep testimony at around 2 minutes and say your full name and begin testifying when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good afternoon. My name is Julia Decker. I'm the Policy Director for Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, or ILCM. ILCM is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that provides free legal services for immigrants and refugees across Minnesota. We are here to respectfully express opposition to HF 772. First and foremost, immigration enforcement is a federal government function. Obligating state and local authorities to help carry out that function runs counter to baseline principles of federalism and anti-commandeering. In addition, we are concerned that the amended language of HF 772 creates real possibilities for erroneous and potentially discriminatory notifications about people in state custody. The bill language appears to expand the requirement to assess, expands the requirement of state and local officials to assess whether a person appears to be a non-citizen. We're concerned about this for a couple of reasons. First, immigration statuses and authorizations are complex. A person born outside U.S. borders may in fact be a U.S. citizen. A person with a final order of deportation may in fact hold work authorization because they would face torture if they were deported. A person can appear to be many things based on race, ethnicity, or even immigration paperwork, but their actual immigration situation may be both nuanced and complicated. Second, we note that federal immigration landscape is currently changing on an almost day-to-day basis. Humanitarian immigration programs such as temporary protected status and parole are being restricted or terminated, and lawsuits are being filed. Asking state and local officials to understand these many different immigration statuses, the effect of programmatic changes, the outcomes of lawsuits that have been filed, are being filed, will be filed, and then assess people in their custody for these various things creates a substantial and ongoing administrative burden, which takes resources away from state and local public safety. And for that reason, we respectfully ask that the committee vote no on HF 772. Thank you.
Next is Edgar Castillo. Mr. Castillo, when you sit down, give your full name and begin your testimony.
My name is Edgar Castillo. I'm a senior assistant county attorney at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I've spent my entire legal career as a prosecutor. I've asked for prison sentences. I've protected our senior citizens from financial exploitation as a member of the Complex Financial Crimes Team, and I've prosecuted other violent crimes. I also advise my office on immigration policy. Every day, prosecutors across the state bring criminal defendants to justice, ensuring that the most violent and dangerous offenders serve hard time in our prisons and jails. HF 772 would make securing jail and prison sentences more difficult. In 2021, 98.5% of felony convictions throughout Minnesota were obtained without a trial. And that's coming from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission statistics report in 2021. By forcing jail and prisons to report inmates to ICE, HF 772 would make it more difficult for prosecutors to negotiate guilty pleas for the most violent non-citizen offenders, because those pleas are typically conditioned on prison or jail time, and non-citizens would be willing to roll the dice. By making it more difficult to obtain plea agreements on jail or prison time, HF 772 will increase trial loads for prosecutors who already spend sleepless nights preparing multiple trials a week against our most dangerous offenders. It would force victims to have to come in and testify more often, including children who have gone through traumatic experiences who would have to face their abusers and look them in the eyes. It would force police officers to get off of our streets, stop patrolling, stop investigating, stop training, and instead come in to testify more often. And it would increase the risk that violent and dangerous offenders will be acquitted at trial. The Hennepin County Attorney's Office joins the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and the Association of Minnesota Counties in urging this committee to reject HF 772 for our public safety. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Before I go any farther, made a statement that they oppose it. We received a letter that said they have concerns about language that's in the bill. Members, do we have any questions for Ms. Chair Swazinski or his testifiers? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can't see you, but I know you're there. Oh, hi. I have concerns with this underlying statute as it existed before your bill to amend it. I'd considered introducing a bill to repeal it altogether, but then didn't get around to it. But I really just do believe that entanglement of our state agencies and our local government and federal immigration law is really problematic. Immigration law is so complicated, and especially in this context, when we're talking about people who are incarcerated and also struggling with mental illness, I think it's even more complicated. Also, I'll just note, it's just kind of interesting that the statute was originally from 1927, because that was just a terrible time in immigration history in the United States. We passed the 1924 Act. What was it called? Anyway, it was like it was like the National Origins, where we just kind of divided the world up by race. Our modern immigration laws started in 1952, and it was an effort to go away from where we had gone in the 1920s. So I think that's a reason to revisit the statute, because that was sort of what it was born from, which was this really erroneous concept that we conflate immigrants with criminals. And I just encourage members to look. The Cato Institute, which is a conservative organization, has some materials that they submitted just showing that immigrants, including undocumented immigrants, commit crimes at lower rates than people born in the United States. And I just wanted to lift up that data. I don't think that this amended language is really that problematic. I think that the underlying statute is based on some erroneous, problematic assumptions. And so I just wanted to raise those concerns. Thank you.
Lee Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just echo what Vice Chair Feist, soon to be Vice Chair Feist, said. I think especially with the amendment that you offered today, less concerned about the bill now with the amendment that you offered, but do have issues really kind of with the underlying statute, especially around the word, if it appears the person is an alien. I think that appearance is problematic, but again, that's in the underlying statute. So I think the fact that your language is really my understanding putting into practice what is done already. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with moving the bill today. Just want to say that really the underlying statute itself is what I think has more problems, but I'm still prepared to vote
yes today.
Closing arguments.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Chair Mueller, you know, I have spoken with representatives from the sheriff's organizations, and we do look forward to continue to work on this bill as it potentially moves forward. You know, I do believe that, you know, we do have a role in this, and we do have an opportunity to make sure that we are state, local governments are within compliance with the law. We can make a disagreement whether or not we like the law or not, but it's important that as legislators that we are we try to do our best job to make sure that we are in compliance with state law. So that can be a different debate, maybe for a different day, whether or not this should be part of our portfolio of things that we get to do. But at the end of the day, I think it's you know, we're seeing that this is a big conversation that's happened nationally and within our state as well. And so with that, I just appreciate your vote. Thank you.
I renew my motion to House File 772. Amended is recommended to be re-referred to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor of this, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. The motion carries, and House File 772, as amended, is re-referred to Human Services. Thank you, Chair Swazinski. The last bill on the agenda today is House File 16. Representative Reimer, please come to the table with your testifiers. Representative Reimer, since you are not a member of the committee, I will move your bill before the committee with a recommendation. It is re-referred to Elections, Finance, and Government Operations. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the Public Safety Committee for meeting on this bill today. I want to yield some time for my testifiers here, so I'll be very quick in what this bill does. This bill, it accomplishes two main things. The first is that it mandates any illegal immigrant arrested on suspicion of a violent crime as defined by Minnesota State Statute 624-172 Subdivision 5, even in cases where the county attorney elects not to prosecute, be reported to ICE. Secondly, this bill prevents state and local entities from actively prohibiting, restricting, or interfering with federal immigration authorities in carrying out the federal immigration enforcement. And just to kind of outline the statute that we're talking about when we talk about violent crime, this bill is narrow in focus. When we talk about that specific statute, we're talking about murder, assault, domestic assault, crimes committed for the benefit of a gang, robbery, carjacking, kidnapping, and criminal sexual conduct. And what the motive is for this bill is to open up a line of communication between local authorities and dealing with dangerous criminals who should not be in our community. That is what this bill does. And right now we find ourselves at a moment where you have local officials who are openly defying immigration enforcement and the language around it. From the Minneapolis mayor to the Hennepin County prosecutor. And what we're trying to do is say we want to open up a line of communication between local authorities who are on the ground, who deal with these people all the time, and make sure that we're actually reporting potentially dangerous criminals in our community. And there are real-world implications to this bill, some of which you will hear about today. And with that, I'll go back to the chair.
Thank you. You have testified and are signed up. We have Charles Thayer. Mr. Thayer, please state your full name and begin your testimony.
Thank you for having me here today. My name is Charles Thayer. I'm here to talk about the death and brutal murder of my mother, America Thayer. In order to understand the true impact this has had on my family, you should probably know a little bit about the history of my mother and I. She and I were both born in Dominican Republic. She had me when she was 16 years young. When I was 4 years old, we legally migrated to the United States together. She was so excited to start her new life with my father and I in the promised land, the home of the free, Los Estados Unidos. Being that she was such a young lady, it literally felt like we were brother and sister still learning the language and culture together. I loved having such a young mother. I always thought I was so lucky that I would be able to share a very long life with her because of her age. She was a young, fun, and vibrant lady with tons of class and a magnetic personality. Everyone she came in contact with would fall in love with her, and she had a smile that would light up any occasion. She's very loyal to my much older father and stayed with him until he passed at the age of 81. After that, she was in a transition stage in her life and decided it would be best for her to be closer to her sisters, so she moved to Atlanta, Georgia, where she could start a new chapter. My mother and I were in regular contact. We always made it a point to stay connected. About 7 years ago, my mother told me about a new guy friend she was talking to. Of course, we all wanted her to be happy, so we embraced and supported her having a new relationship. Shortly after they started dating, my mother would call me up regarding the financial issues she was having and not being able to pay her bills and make ends meet. This was odd for her to do. After sending her money several times, she continued to ask for more. After sending her more and more, she continued asking about once per month, and I also received a call from her concerned boss of the retail store she worked at, asking me if I knew anything about this new guy she was dating. Her boss told me she was starting to miss work regularly. She also told me that her new boyfriend would take her car while she was working and return it to pick her up after her shift. She said he would even sometimes wait all day outside the store for her to finish working. Everyone knew something was off about this relationship and had a bad, very, very bad feeling about him. This went on until my mother was eventually fired for the first time ever from her work. Since all this was so odd, we as a family began getting more and more concerned about who this new boyfriend of hers was. We ended up doing some research on him and found out that he was an illegal alien and a convicted felon in another state. What was even more scary was that he was convicted of trying to stab his previous girlfriend and went to prison for it. My mother would regularly try to convince us that he was a good guy and he would never hurt her. That was until she called me up a few weeks later crying about him beating her up and she ended up having a broken wrist. This is when we knew she was with a woman abuser. We still never would have imagined what would eventually have happened to her and why we're all here today. The concern we had for her would remain, but the contact I had with her was becoming less and less. I would only hear from her when she was needing money or when he would beat her up and threaten her life. Those calls would continue to get more and more desperate over the years. After sending them tens of thousands of dollars in payments for vehicles and deposits on apartments, their situation stayed the same and would always revert to rock bottom. They ended up homeless, unemployed together, but of course, unemployed was his regular status. She would work and earn the money from three jobs, and he would wait for her to bring it home so he could spend it on drugs, alcohol, nothing productive, and then beat her up some more. Eventually, we gave my mother a way out, moved back with us to Minnesota, and leave the abuser behind. She did take up our offer, and we flew her back to Minnesota with a one-way ticket. This was another new start for her. But after just a few weeks, she was talking to him again. She eventually convinced us that he wanted to change, that he wanted to get his citizenship, earn a job, and build a family with her. Her desire to get back with him eventually got to us even, and we decided to help him and her so they could be together and start over again closer to us. We paid for him to come to Minnesota. We gave him money so he could start the process and become a citizen. We bought them another car so they could commute to work, and we paid for another deposit on an apartment. Things seemed well for about 2 weeks, and then the phone rang again. Son, he beat the crap out of me. My mother would plea as she cried hysterically. She would leave him. Then a few days later, she would take him back. This happened so many times. Sometimes the police were called and sometimes not. Eventually, we as a family told her he was just too dangerous to bring around the rest of us. So if she wanted an in-person relationship with us, she would have to leave him. Unfortunately, my mom could not find a way out. She said he would kill her if he knew that she was going to leave him. I still could not understand how a grown, capable man could allow his girlfriend to work three jobs to support them both and show his appreciation by beating her up regularly and constantly controlling her in every move. She could not even answer the phone without him listening in the background for something he didn't like, so he could beat her up later because of it. This continued regularly, and about a year before he successfully murdered her, he made his first attempt to kill her. He beat her up in a Bloomington apartment they had, doused her entirely in gasoline, and started the place on fire. This was on the news. She escaped with only minor injuries, but he had a standoff with police and eventually jumped out of a second-story window down onto parked cars below, where he would get arrested for several crimes committed that day, including arson and whatever. We honestly thought this would be the end, or the proverbial straw, that would make her realize just how dangerous he was. If my mother only loved herself as much as we all loved her, this would have been the end. But she worried about him, and in her loyal, loving fashion, she forgave him and took him back. She wrote a letter to the judge in Shakopee, begging for him to be allowed bail, and promising she would see to it that he returned for his arson case for all the dates and the sentencing. The judge in that case allowed for bail, and of course, my mother scratched, begged, and borrowed enough money from friends and colleagues to bail him out. This would prove to be her final fatal move. The day he killed her, she was bringing him to a final court appearance where he would be sentenced and incarcerated, hopefully. He ended up beating her skull in with a blunt object and cut her head off at the neck in broad daylight right in front of a busy intersection while she was still alive in Shakopee. I will never grow old with my mother as I thought I would when I was a young boy. My children will no longer have their grandmother to share stories and laugh with. My aunt lost her sister and best friend. The world lost a special ray of light in all of the darkness. Our family will never be the same without her, and this has left an ugly stain on our family and our legacy. The only question I really have left is how anybody on any side of any aisle would ever have a problem with reporting dangerous criminals to ICE so they can be considered for deportation immediately. Thank you.
Mr. Thayer, please extend our feelings for your loss. I will say that there is a story on this, as well as a large packet for members with letters of support and opposition. With that, the rest of testimony, we have a long list of testifiers. We're going to start off with Representative Mr. Zimmer. We have 11 or 12 now signed up. So, Mr. Zimmer, if you could keep it short, we're going 2 minutes. There's a timer at the front of the room.
Chair Novotny and committee members, I am David Zimmer, Public Safety Policy Fellow with Center of the American Experiment. I appear today in support of House File 16. I'm going to shorten my comments to fit within the 2 minutes. It's important to know that House File 16 aligns well with current federal law, which states no state or local government entity may be permitted or in any way restricted from sending to or receiving from ICE information regarding the immigration status, lawful or unlawful, of an alien in the United States. As a bit of a background, I retired 3 years ago from local law enforcement. During my career, I served in several leadership capacities that involved cooperating with ICE, including as the captain of the Hennepin County Jail. I saw firsthand the importance of interagency cooperation with all our federal partners, including ICE. Last year, during the debate that surrounded the North Star Bill, I became concerned with some of the narratives being used that didn't fit with the reality that I knew. I'd like to address House File 16 in the lens of some of those narratives. First, the idea that cooperating with ICE is a waste of finite time and resources for local law enforcement, it simply falls flat. A core tenet of law enforcement is that officers and agencies help each other when needed. This spirit of cooperation runs both ways, and it serves as the foundation for law enforcement, which depends on force multipliers to properly address public safety issues. Throughout my career, I personally worked with a myriad of federal agencies. I have about 15 listed here, but I won't go through them. Today's officers continue to routinely partner with federal authorities on a variety of matters. It's completely appropriate for our law enforcement to collect as much biographical data as they can when they detain somebody. It would be inappropriate for an officer not to attempt to determine the country of origin or nationality of a potential unauthorized immigrant that they are dealing with. This information facilitates several things, including mandated foreign consulate notifications checking on the existence of outstate and international warrants, checking on the existence of terrorism watch list notifications, and assisting with future follow-up or attempts to locate the individual. It's important to note that our data practices statutes, which govern law enforcement data, already mandate the sharing of that information in many instances and allow for it in others. To suggest that we should create firewalls or carve out an exception to the sharing of this data with ICE is an uncalled for obstruction of an appropriate law enforcement process. House File 16 would also help address the problem created by ICE detainer requests. Due to the massive volume of unauthorized immigrants ICE is responsible for, ICE tends to rely almost solely on the civil detainer and deportation process rather than the more time-consuming criminal prosecution process. But this civil process doesn't mesh well with the detention timelines that govern local law enforcement. This dilemma would be eliminated by more timely and appropriate sharing of information with ICE, like we do with every other federal partner. Absent this timely notification, ICE is frequently unable to take custody of individuals at the time their local holds expire. I'll wrap it up here. I urge you to vote yes on House File 16. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmer. We have next on the list will be Ben Gleckel, and then on deck is Madeline Lohman. Mr. Gleckel, please state your full name in the way it's supposed to be pronounced, because I don't think it probably got it right, and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. My name is Ben Gleckel, and I'm a removal defense attorney at the Immigrant Law Center in Minnesota. We are here to respectfully express opposition to HF 16. This bill will make all people residing in Minnesota less safe. Non-citizen and citizen victims of domestic violence and trafficking will suffer the most. They will not risk calling local law enforcement to report a crime if they know that it means their families will be separated, or that they themselves might be apprehended by Immigration and Customs Enforcement as collateral. Requiring reporting to ICE and prohibiting entities that know their communities best from maintaining clear boundaries between state and federal government will erode the important trust that exists between our immigrant communities and our local law enforcement. We will all be less safe as a result. This bill will also have detrimental impacts on the rights of people in Minnesota. Immigrants and even U.S. citizens in our state are already being approached and subsequently detained by ICE agents based on the color of their skin alone. Facilitating the deportation of a person for an arrest stemming from a mere suspicion is a disproportionate measure. Families will be separated and people will be deported to countries where their lives are at risk, not because of a valid criminal charge or conviction that they received, but because of an arrest based on suspicion alone. Mandatory notification to ICE will circumvent Minnesota's criminal justice process by facilitating the deportation of a person before their case has concluded, eroding due process rights along the way. For these reasons, we respectfully ask the committee to vote no on HF 16. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gleckel. Next up, Madeline Lohman. On deck, Joshua Muscatento. State your full name and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Madeline Lohman. Thank you, Chair Novotny, Lead Mueller, and members of the committee. The Advocates for Human Rights respectfully opposes HF 16. Other testifiers are going to speak about public safety, trust, resources, domestic violence. I am going to talk about how this bill provides a tool in the hands of human traffickers to keep their victims scared and trapped. Minnesota is a national leader in combating sex and labor trafficking, and the laws and appropriations that we put towards this issue are bipartisan. HF 16 threatens to undo that work. Our organization provides legal services to foreign national victims of trafficking and collaborates with organizations and government agencies around the state to improve policies, protocols, and responses. We see firsthand the negative consequences for individuals, communities, and public safety when the line between federal immigration enforcement and local government gets blurred. In one recent case, an abusive employer threatened not to renew visas for nearly 100 farm workers, using that threat to keep them in houses with inadequate heat, forcing them to work without clean water or bathroom breaks, and refusing to let them leave the property unless they were monitored at all times. Facing threats of immigration enforcement, the workers felt safe to come forward only because of policies that protected them from retaliatory reports to immigration enforcement. Without these policies, the case against the trafficker would not have been successful. We also work on cases where children were forced to work in factories, agriculture, and street vending by predatory traffickers who refused to let them attend immigration court hearings, resulting in adverse rulings that keep the children in exploitative conditions. Separation policies let us assure these children that they can talk to our law enforcement partners safely. In case after case, we see that traffickers manipulate and exploit fear of immigration enforcement, even in situations where a person has legal status in the United States. If state and local law enforcement agencies cannot send a clear message that they are not extensions of ICE, that they care about individual and community safety above immigration status, then trafficking victims will listen to traffickers who tell them that no one cares, no one will help, and there is no way out. The Advocate for Human Rights respectfully urges the committee to vote no on HF 16. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Joshua Muscanto.
Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joshua.
Next up is Lillian Carcamo. And Mr. State your full name and begin your testimony.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Joshua Muscanto. I've worked in the security industry for nearly 14 years. I currently work third shift as a level 2 officer in downtown Minneapolis. Over the years, I have handled a large range of security issues, including arson, trespassing, vandalism, domestic violence, stalking, suicides, behavioral crises, accidents, muggings, and sexual assault. We are the first preventers. Our union, SEIU Local 26, takes safety very seriously. Today I am speaking in opposition to HF 16, which I believe will make Minnesota less safe by eroding community trust and overburdening law enforcement with additional duties not directly related to the safety of our state. What's more, HF 16 could potentially lead to civil rights violations. The State Department's Catch and Revoke program is currently making use of an anti-Semitic McCarthy-era law to revoke student visas of protesters, but with a modern twist. They're using AI to monitor social media accounts. We have already seen the devastating effects of the Catch and Revoke program, including the detainment of Mahmoud Khalil by ICE. This is 1952 meets 1984. Now is not the time to sit and play dead whenever ICE commands. This is our state, our tax dollars. We have a right to make sure those dollars are spent on things that actually make our state safer, like more training for security officers, more resources for victims of domestic violence, common sense gun control, and addressing the economic insecurities that are at the root of the majority of crimes. If someone needed my help, I would hope their immigration status would not make them hesitate to approach me. We cannot afford to go backwards on building community trust for the sake of Trump's agenda, an agenda that most of us Minnesotans do not support. While there are many bills I would endorse to advance the safety of our state, when it comes to HF 16, which I believe will make us less safe, I ask you to vote no.
Thank you. Lillian Carcamo, and next up is David Campana.
Dear Chairman Novotny and members of committee, my name is Lillian Carcamo. I live in Coon Rapids, Minnesota. My son Josue is reading my testimony. I fled abuse in Guatemala and arrived in the United States in 2004. I began dating a man here who I will call Ivan. Unfortunately, he drank and physically abused me. One time he headbutted me so hard it split open my forehead. I ended that relationship, but he discovered I was pregnant with Ivan's child. Shortly after, I went with a friend to rent a video and I saw Ivan. He did not know I was pregnant. I tried talking with him, but he had another woman with him. I asked who she was, and the other woman said, I'm his wife. Who are you? I didn't know he was married. He lied and said to her, I don't recognize this woman. I was upset and told him I was pregnant with his child. His wife was also pregnant. I asked for an explanation, but he struck me twice in the face. I left the store with my face badly wounded. My friend took pictures of my face, and together we went to the police station and report Ivan's beating me. If I had thought the police were going to report me to immigration, I would not have gone. The police later arrested Ivan for the crimes he committed against me. He made a plea bargain. Eventually, I was able to ask for a U visa for victims of crime and get permanent residency. On November 25, 2024, I became a U.S. citizen. I ask you to oppose House File 16 so others in situations like mine feel safe enough to help the police. I had submitted a longer version of my story. Thank you for your time. Lillian Carcamo, United States citizen.
Next up, David Campana, and on deck is Sarah Silva. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, dear Chairman Novotny and committee members. My name is David Campana. I am the Legislative and Policy Director in Economic Development for the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. The Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs is a state agency that advises and informs the legislature and government on issues relevant to our diverse Latino communities. The Council wishes to express its opposition to House File 16. These proposals are detrimental to our constituents and counterproductive to public safety, undermining the trust between local authorities and immigrant communities. The proposed legislation will also have negative economic impacts by compromising the important contributions of the immigrant population to the Minnesota economy. A recent report by the Minnesota Chamber Foundation has found that, quote, nearly 60% of the state's total labor force and employment growth came from foreign-born workers from 2019 to 2023. And also, that Minnesota's foreign-born population is becoming more highly educated, skilled, and entrepreneurial, which could spur future innovation and productivity. Being an immigrant myself, I am proud of the contributions of immigrants to our state, although I can assure you that it has not been an easy ride. Originally from Peru, a labor and human rights attorney, practitioner, and university professor, I had to learn a new language, go back to school to earn a master's degree, and eventually find my way to insert myself in a new place that I now call home. This is a difficult journey that we immigrants have to navigate. Immigration non-cooperation policies that create separation between local officials, work, and federal immigration enforcement contribute to public safety and well-being for all Minnesotans. The Council trusts you that you will make the right decision in preventing policies to protect the vulnerable and promote a safer Minnesota. Thank you for your time and attention to this important matter.
Thank you. Next up, Sarah Silva. On deck, Mantha Chum. State your name, begin your testimony.
Sarah Silva. Members of the committee, thank you so much for...
You got to have to get closer to the mic, ma'am.
Can you guys hear me a little bit? Okay. Dear members of the committee, thank you so much for gathering today for this bill. I know we are busy this season. My name is Sarah Silva, and I am the policy coordinator for the North Star Alliance. The North Star Alliance includes dozens of community-based and faith-based organizations who believe in the dignity and human being, who believe in the dignity and respect of one another without exception. We strongly oppose House File 16, which would erode local control of finite government resources and has the potential to pit Minnesota communities and counties against each other. It prohibits local police, it prohibits local policies of non-cooperation, overriding community-based approaches designed to foster trust and safety. Minnesota's police department cannot afford another lawsuit. Minnesota's police department cannot afford another murder like George Floyd's. Minnesota cannot afford farms, agriculture. Do we really have more money right now to pay for any of those things? You rely on immigrants. And I'm proud to be from Mexico. We need to understand that this isn't us against them. We are in serious trouble, and it's time for you guys to talk to each other and work together. We are tired. Taxpayers deserve more than you guys funding jails. You would actually save money. Who doesn't want to save money? We need it for food. Let's be honest about what is happening right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Martha Chum, and on deck, Commissioner Barnett. State your name and begin your testimony, please.
My name is Monta Chum, and I'm the executive director of Minnesota 8 and a co-founder there. I am here today to express my strong opposition to HF 16. We must keep our community safe and allow community values to be at the center of our policies. HF 16 is based on false narratives around immigrants that is designed to divide us, dehumanize us, and weaken our bonds to one another. This rhetoric is really dangerous and fuels policies that strip away dignity and human rights instead of division. I ask for you to listen to our stories. To understand the harmful impacts of this bill, I stand before all of you to remind us about the true stories of immigrants and refugees like myself, many of whom cannot be in the room today. Minnesota is home to one of the largest Southeast Asian refugee populations in the world. During the Vietnam War, the United States dropped more than 2 million tons of bombs in Laos and Cambodia and waged illegal warfare using tactics that are now banned because of how atrocious they were. This caused the mass displacement of over 1.2 million Southeast Asian refugees. We are here because the United States was there. Refugees came here because our homelands were bombed, destroyed, and destabilized. My family survived the killing fields during the Khmer Rouge, a genocide that stole the lives of over 1.3 million Cambodians. People were forced into labor camps. They were separated from their families and persecuted. Refugees and immigrants have survived unimaginable violence. These are the true narratives of immigrants, and all we've ever dreamed of is to be in a peaceful and safe world. Many immigrants came here because they yearned for safety. However, ICE detention and deportation reflects the cruel conditions of wartime concentration camps and are parallel to the extreme violence we once fled from. For many, it's a death sentence. And once we fled, for many, since January, dozens of people have come to us because their loved ones have been detained at work, in their cars, and at their senior living facilities and in their homes. My brother, I experienced this very firsthand because in 2016, my brother was detained and picked up for ICE, and I watched his young daughter, not understanding why her dad would not never come home. And right now, we have a choice to choose humanity. HF 16 is a threat to public safety, and it is opposite of everything Minnesota stands for. I urge you to choose love over fear. Reject HF 16 and instead pass policies that center our shared humanity. Every single person deserves safety and dignity, especially refugees and immigrants who survived the unspeakable to be here today. And as a follower of Jesus, I just want to end with this. We need to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. Ensure justice for those being crushed. Yes, really speak up for the poor and helpless and see that they get justice. True justice does not favor the powerful at the expense of the weak, but seeks to bring about flourishing for all, especially the oppressed and marginalized. Thank you.
Mr. Barnett, state your full name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Todd Barnett. I'm the Commissioner of Community Safety for the City of Minneapolis. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on behalf of the City of Minneapolis related to this bill. First and foremost, I want to highlight that the legislation here would have a profound negative impact on our community safety operations in the City of Minneapolis. As you know, we've gone through a lot as a city since 2020 with the murder of George Floyd, civil unrest, and the COVID pandemic as it relates to community trust. When communities trust local government, especially local law enforcement, residents are more likely to report crimes, cooperate with investigations, and engage with police. If community members fear that interaction with city staff or law enforcement could lead to immigration enforcement, they may avoid reporting crimes or seeking help, which can undermine our public safety efforts. Many people may avoid accessing essential services such as healthcare, education, and social services if they fear that these interactions might expose them to immigration enforcement. Maintaining community trust ensures that all residents and visitors to the City of Minneapolis, regardless of immigration status, can access necessary services without fear of repercussions. By preempting Minneapolis and other cities' separation ordinance, this bill would result in decreased safety for Minneapolis and its residents, and it would directly impact the trust that the public and residents have with the city and with our city staff and officers. The City of Minneapolis's separation ordinance, which was passed over 20 years ago, clearly states that the city employees shall not inquire about immigration status except in limited circumstances. It also indicates that the city employees, including law enforcement officers and emergency personnel, should not participate in immigration operations. And there are limited exceptions to that. As a whole, the ordinance was advanced to increase trust between the city and its residents. This is especially important for individuals who are vulnerable to exploitation, people who have been exploited, or people who are victims of crime for whom there should be no barriers to them reporting a crime or seeking services to address trauma or harm. We strongly believe that this measure, if advanced, will not promote public safety, but instead decrease community trust in our government and make our society less safe. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. And Commissioner Barnett, are you going to be sticking around? I know some of the members might have questions for you.
Yes.
Okay. And for the other testifiers that have been here, if you can, please stick around if there's any questions for you. Next up is Jess Paleon of Violence Free Minnesota. On deck is Darcy McCampbell.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jess Paleon. I'm the Policy Program Manager at Violence Free Minnesota. We are the statewide coalition against domestic violence, and we represent we consist of over 90 member programs who provide direct services to victims, survivors of domestic and sexual violence in every corner of Minnesota. Domestic violence is about power and control. Any vulnerability that a survivor presents becomes a lever which can be pulled to maintain or establish power and control. Immigration status is one of those levers. House File 16 would exacerbate pre-existing barriers that undocumented survivors face when trying to interact with law enforcement and other public safety resources. Without having access to an external support system, undocumented survivors will be made more vulnerable to domestic violence. In 2018, the ACLU released the results of a survey of police officers, judges, and prosecutors about the impacts of stricter immigration control on the willingness of undocumented people to cooperate in investigations and report crime. In the survey, 69% of police officers and 82% of prosecutors said that they believe that domestic violence had become harder to investigate due to victim unwillingness to come forward. This data squares with everything we've heard from our direct service providers and advocates around the unique challenges faced by undocumented survivors of violence. Some quotes from our member programs on this issue include, "There is a lot of fear for undocumented survivors and often threats made by their abuser that they'll be deported or lose their kids." Another quote, "Survivors fear ICE. They fear their abuser calling ICE. They fear their abuser having all their papers. They fear their abuser threatening to keep kids and have the victim deported." Even when a survivor is a documented immigrant, their abuser might control their important identifying documents, visa paperwork, or other crucial documentation. They may also prevent survivors from making it to crucial appointments regarding their immigration status. Immigration law and the rights available to immigrants is inherently complicated, fast-changing, and bureaucratic. Adding in a layer of abuse makes it even more likely that these barriers result in somebody losing their status, or at the very least not being able to prove their legal status. Because of these power dynamics, laws like House File 16 put documented immigrants at an increased risk of negative immigration consequences when they suffer abuse. Undocumented survivors of violence are your neighbors. They deserve your support, and they deserve to have a state which supports their ability to seek justice when harmed. There's more to say, but I will wrap with this. I want to draw attention to a letter in your packet from all six Crime Victim Services coalitions. We all signed this because there is consensus among us that keeping Minnesota safer involves making sure that everybody can access law enforcement resources. Thank you.
Thank you. Darcy Campbell, next up on deck is Peter Castillo. Go ahead, state your name, begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Darcy McCampbell. I live in Minneapolis, and I work as a registered nurse based in the Twin Cities. I'm here to express my opposition to HF 16. The testimony I'm giving is my own and does not represent my employers. As a nurse, I have the privilege of serving both as a community health nurse, focused on creating healthier and more equitable communities, and the forensic nurse, navigating the intersections between healthcare and the criminal legal system in order to interrupt cycles of violence and injustice. In my community health role, I work across the state to bridge gaps in access to healthcare for Minnesota's diverse communities. As a forensic nurse, I work in the emergency department to provide acute care to individuals who've experienced sexual violence, intimate partner violence, trafficking, and exploitation. Trust is fundamental to providing the essential trauma-informed healthcare following an assault. Forensic exams move at the speed of trust in order to understand what each unique individual needs for healing, hope, and safety. For some individuals, that process includes reporting to law enforcement. Across my nursing roles, I often serve individuals who are undocumented, newly arrived, refugees, and other non-citizens. As I navigate the intersection between healthcare and the criminal legal system, I'm acutely aware of the barriers that exist for immigrant communities. Without trust that information will not be shared with immigration authorities, victims and survivors, regardless of their legal status, will be less willing to seek out the care they need and deserve. This bill erodes that trust in local law enforcement and risks harm to community health for all Minnesotans. As a nurse and Minnesota resident, I stand firmly against HF 16. It is essential that we foster an environment where all Minnesotans can feel safe to access care, free from fear of discrimination or deportation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Castillo. And next up is Anna Patzrantes Costa. State your name, begin your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify again. Edgar Castillo, Senior Assistant County Attorney for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. In conjunction with HF 772, HF 16 drafts our police officers, prosecutors,
and corrections officers into the federal immigration bureaucracy. HF 16 undermines three shared responsibilities: the responsibility to wisely steward law enforcement resources, to stand up for victims of crime, and to bring violent and dangerous offenders to justice. I'll take each one in part. First of all, it would divert resources from our police and our prosecutors away from crime fighting and into filing reports and identifying people's immigration statuses, all without extra funding from this body or from the federal government. Every minute spent working for the federal immigration bureaucracy is a minute not spent crime fighting. Envision this: slower 911 response times, less time for violent investigations, less time for training and readiness. This is a tax on the time of our police and our prosecutors. Second, HF 16 would prevent victims and witnesses from talking to our police and from testifying in our trials. We are already seeing this all across the state. That's why our office passed the nation's best UNT visa policy in order to secure witnesses, which we do, and to secure convictions, which we also do. Last of all, violent and dangerous offenders would brandish HF 16 like a weapon. Who needs a gun when you have HF 16? Who needs a knife when you have HF 16? HF 16 would give violent and dangerous offenders a menu of false accusations to lodge against victims to silence them or even disappear them out of this country. Violent and dangerous offenders will escape justice if HF 16 passes, and they will have free rein to run roughshod through our neighborhoods. HF 16 makes Minnesotans less safe. Our office joins the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, the County Attorneys Association, the League of Minnesota Cities, and a Crime Victims Coalition, and urge this committee to swiftly reject HF 16. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I will bet in that case, once again, remind the committee that that is not the position that the Sheriff's Office took. They said they had concerns, but not opposition. There is one person that was added to the testimony list, but I can't read my handwriting. First name, Evan. And are you Anna?
Yes.
Please state your full name and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Anna Patratz-Acosta, and I'm a professor of law at Mitchell-Hamlin. And I'll begin my testimony. So I am a professor at Mitchell-Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota, where I specialize in the areas of immigration law, public benefits for non-citizens, and immigration status as a social determinant of health. And I'm here today to present my testimony to this committee in my professional capacity as a law professor with specialized knowledge regarding the intersection of immigration law and health law in opposition to House File 16. Specifically, I submit this testimony to express my opposition to House File 16 on account of the language in the bill in its current form that inadequately protects the private health information and school enrollment information, as well as other private data, from disclosure. Additionally, I submit this testimony in opposition to House File 16 on account of the likely harm this bill would have on the health and welfare of Minnesota's immigrant community. In its current form, House File 16 would prohibit Minnesota government entities or responsible authorities from limiting or restricting the sharing of information or personal data pertaining to immigration status that's maintained by Minnesota government entities with federal agencies for immigration enforcement purposes. The broad scope of the language in House File 16, so specifically the proposed amendments to Minnesota Statute 13.02, Section 1, Paragraphs A and B, which would require all Minnesota government entities, including schools and healthcare providers, to comply with requests for data by federal government agencies for immigration enforcement purposes, directly conflicts with existing federal and state data protection laws, including the Minnesota Data Practices Act, as well as HIPAA and FERPA, which are federal laws pertaining to health and school education records. While House File 16 does contain carve-out language permitting exceptions or restrictions as required by any other state or local law, no such language exists to account for conflicting federal law, including HIPAA and FERPA. Because Minnesota government entities include covered healthcare entities, for example, HCMC Medical System operated by Hennepin County, which are subject to HIPAA in public schools, like the University of Minnesota, it fails to account for conflicts with existing federal law. For this reason and for other reasons set forth in my written testimony, I oppose House File 16. Thank you.
Thank you. Evan Hermoda. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Novotny and Representative Mueller, for the opportunity to speak here today. My name is Evan Hermada, and I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. I have a master's degree in public policy and a master's degree in public health from the University of Minnesota. I oppose HF 16. HF 16 would erode public health and consequently erode public safety. Strong public health creates strong public safety. The goal of this bill is to promote public safety, but instead, this bill will make our communities less safe by further pressing undocumented immigrants to live in the shadows. Prohibiting non-cooperation of government entities will harm communities when immigrant communities fear seeking treatment. In addition to this, HF 16 conflicts with HIPAA, the Federal Health Data Privacy Act. HF 16 attempts to prohibit safeguarding of data relating to immigration status by any state and government employees, including by any local or county public health department. Access to quality and affordable health care should not be dependent upon immigration status. This bill has the effect of removing access to treatment for undocumented immigrants while increasing prices for people with legal status. Undocumented immigrants already have less access to health insurance compared to legal residents. Less access to insurance will increase as the state removes the opportunity for undocumented immigrants to seek treatment without fear of data being reported to immigration officials. My studies in public health taught me more healthy people in the insurance pool will spread the risk for everyone, resulting in lower premiums. Our goal should be to make insurance more accessible without fear of data being shared to facilitate premiums decreasing. Data from the Migration Policy Institute shows that only 18% of the undocumented immigrant population in the state are over 45 years old, meaning that 82% of undocumented immigrants in the insurance pool who could be chilled out of their policy or scared out of applying to one in the first place. These are people who could help bring premium prices down for you and residents in your district so long as they feel safe seeking government assistance. We have seen consequences outside of insurance that follow when undocumented immigrants skip preventative care and resort to emergency rooms when their needs become acute. Once undocumented immigrants have to seek emergency care without insurance, then costs increase for emergency visits as the ERs raise prices to make up the difference. This means higher prices for constituents. Undocumented immigrants who seek vaccines at county public health departments will fear their data being sent out to federal immigration enforcement, and this may affect their willingness to get vaccinated. The vaccine rate of Minnesota is already not what it needs to be for many important childhood vaccines. Even the smallest decline of community vaccination rates places everyone at risk for preventable diseases. Minnesota Health Fairview explains that for herd immunity from measles, a 95% vaccination rate is required in communities. The Minnesota Department of Health shows that only 77% of the state have received full doses of the MMR by the age of six. Even the best data suggests that for newborns, the MMR vaccine rate is at 93%. So this bill will increase insurance premiums, medical care costs, and risk of preventable disease while decreasing community safety. For these reasons, I urge you to vote in opposition of HF 16.
Thank you. That'll conclude the listed testifiers. Commissioner Barnett, Representative Witte has a question for you.
Thank you, Chair Novotny.
Mr. Barnett, state your name, please, again, and go ahead, Vice Chair Witte.
Yes, I'm Todd Barnett. I'm the Commissioner of Community Safety for the City of Minneapolis.
Thank you. And during your testimony, you said that the officers have limitations for asking on immigration status. What are the limitations?
Commissioner Barnett.
Chair, Representative, some of those limitations or, well, part of it comes from the ordinance, and the other limitations come from policy in which we don't ask immigration status of individuals. I mean, that's the general rule.
Are there any cases that they're asked? Because you said there were limitations for asking.
No, Commissioner Barnett.
Chair, Representative, there's no limitations as far as cases are concerned.
And my last question.
Vice Chair Whitty.
Sorry. My last question is, since 2020, how many law enforcement agencies is the Minneapolis PD working with to keep their community safe?
Commissioner Barnett.
Chair, Representative, I don't know that number off the top of my head from 2020 until now, the number of agencies that Minneapolis Police Department has worked with, but we have several different agencies that Minneapolis Police are detailed with, like the U.S. Marshals. We also work with DEA as well on certain cases where we have the same interests. There's multiple multiple jurisdictions that work together in different task force, but I don't know the number off the top of my head. I couldn't even give you a ballpark from 2020.
Well, and I was actually
Vice Chair Whitty.
I was actually looking at like today. I know you got State Patrol, all these different agencies, and it's law enforcement working the law enforcement to keep our community safe. So
yeah,
that's what I was, and then you kind of answered it. So thank you.
Commissioner Barnett?
Chair, Representative, yes, today I think the biggest thing that I've seen since I've come into this job over a year ago is that any incident, our first responders, whether it's law enforcement or not, work very well together. If there is a issue that requires the State Patrol or Hennepin County Attorney's Office or a federal agency in which we have a similar interest, then we'll work together to do that. Yes.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let's kind of break this down here. We heard that this bill breaks community trust, it costs money, and who doesn't like saving money? That somehow it makes our state less safe, that this is our state and our tax dollars that are being put at risk if we comply with this bill, and that simply complying with this bill also takes time away from crime fighting. But the good news is, if you are not a murderer, a rapist, an assailant, a gang affiliate, a carjacker, a robber, or a kidnapper, it's your lucky day. This does not apply to you. As of January 21st, this is who it would apply to. It would apply to Christopher Alexander Ramirez Olivia, who was detained by ICE in St. Paul for criminal sexual conduct with a minor. It would apply to Hernando Fidel Avila Gamez, a man in Faribault, who was convicted of felony burglary and criminal sexual conduct. It would apply to a man found in St. Paul, Octavio Juarez Bonilla, who had possession of child pornography. Jesus Baltzar, assault of a child. St. Paul, Oscar Alexander Cruz Rodriguez, a rape of a minor in Venezuela that he was awaiting court on. Alonzo Luna Perez, two counts of assault with intent of sexual abuse. I have more. That's who this bill applies to. This bill applies to nobody else. So when we're saying that it's going to break down public safety, that it's going to break down community trust, it's only going to improve that. Because if those people are in our communities committing those acts, we don't want them there. We don't want those people free to roam and create more victims out of Minnesotans. And I beg the question, what interests in public safety does a law enforcement officer, an agency, a prosecutor, an attorney general, What interest is there in public safety and maintaining public safety and them not complying with this very law? And if there is a logical answer, I don't know. Thank you for that. Where is the public safety interest in protecting folks that I just listed off? And I have more I could go with. If there's a logical answer, I'm waiting for it. Thank you.
Representative Engen, was there a question in there? Or, and if so, was it for Representative Reimer or Commissioner Barnett?
Nope, just open question.
Does anyone else, before we go on, anyone else have a question that'll be directed at Commissioner Barnett, or can he step down from the... Thank you, Commissioner. If
you could step Thank down. You.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to ask if we could have Ms. Patrez Acosta come back up for a question.
If what?
Ms. Patrez Acosta, if All she right. could come back up for a question.
Please state your name again for the transcribers and begin and go ahead, Representative Curran.
Yes. Thank you. Oh, sorry. Ana Patrats Acosta, Professor of Law, Mitchell Hamlin.
Thank you, Chair. We heard a really tragic testimony earlier involving domestic abuse and murder. Clearly an awful, awful situation that should happen to no one. Just thinking about the, you know, real world application or implications of this bill in particular, and as we're trying to tackle issues like that, would House File 16 have prevented the criminal actions in that case?
I don't have your name, but go ahead. Acosta.
Ms. Acosta. before I respond to the question, I just want to echo your comments and express to Mr. Thayer's son, who testified earlier today, that I'm also incredibly sorry for his loss and can't even begin to imagine the pain his family has gone through after losing a loved one in such a senseless tragedy. However, to answer your question, with respect to immigration law, unfortunately, no. The proposed statutory amendments contained in House File 16 would not have prevented this tragedy. When Mr. Sabort Viltreas was present in the U.S. When he committed this crime, it actually had nothing to do with lack of cooperation or sharing of information between local law enforcement in Minnesota and ICE agents working for the Department of Homeland Security. The reality is the sad truth is that this was sort of a perfect storm of events that largely had to do with the fact that he happened to be a national of Cuba, which is a country that historically does not accept deportees because of the strained diplomatic relationship between the United States and Cuba that dates back to the Cold War and the start of the Cuban embargo during the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations in the 1950s and 60s. And just to explain a little bit further, provide a little bit more context, based on the information that I read ahead of today's hearing, it appeared as though he did have an unexecuted removal order, which likely did stem from those previous criminal convictions, which would have made him deportable. And ICE was unable to execute the removal order because he was a national of Cuba. And following a 2001 Supreme Court decision in Zedvides v. Davis, ICE is only allowed to hold an immigrant for a maximum of 180 days after they have received a final removal order if they're not able to execute the removal order and remove them to their country of origin within the foreseeable future. Because of strained diplomatic relations between Cuba and the United States, he was likely released on an order of supervision pending the ability of the United States government to be able to deport him to Cuba. The other thing, too, to keep in mind with an order of supervision is that you have to report to ICE every 6 months or every year. So ICE was likely already very well aware of his whereabouts and location because he would have needed to report to them. The other thing, too, that I think is important to clarify in terms of existing cooperation agreements between state and local law enforcement in Minnesota and the federal government, specifically Homeland Security and ICE, is that we already have a system in place where anytime somebody is arrested and booked and their fingerprints are run through a system, it goes through a number of databases, including the Department of Homeland Security. So when he would have been arrested most recently for arson, ICE would already be aware of that arrest, and his presence would have been flagged in ICE's system when that check was run. And that is a process that has been in place going back about 20 years shortly after 9/11 when those electronic centralized databases were created. So to answer the question, no, it wouldn't have prevented it. And also, really more than anything, because we have systems to run people's information through a database at the time of arrest, House File 16 really is seeking to address a problem that doesn't really exist.
Representative Curran.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks, Ms. Acosta, if you don't have to hang out there if you don't want to. But okay. So Representative Reimer, we've never had the chance to work together, but I appreciated that during all of the testimony you appeared to be listening and thinking about the input that people have been providing. Victims, advocates, the Sheriff's Association didn't oppose, but has, oh, I'm so sorry, apparently I'm speaking too quickly and not into the mic. There are concerns expressed by a really broad variety of stakeholders, and you really appeared to be listening, and I appreciate that. I did want to make one point about Representative Ingen's list of folks. All of those individuals, their information would have been shared already with the federal government under the underlying bill that Representative Swidzinski was seeking to amend. So I just wanted to make it clear that that this House File 16 doesn't actually impact any of those individuals. So I feel strongly that, based on all of the testimony and my 25 years working in the field of immigration law, that this is not good for public safety and that it's harmful to immigrant communities here in Minnesota. And I wanted to highlight for a moment the bipartisan work that I have had the privilege of doing with my colleagues across the aisle since I was first elected and served since 2021. My first session, we passed a bipartisan bill to improve the U visa process for immigrant victims of crimes. I worked closely with the Chiefs of Police Association, and that legislation passed through a divided legislature. We also passed off both House and Senate floor individually a bill to protect neglected, abandoned, or abused immigrant youth. And that passed unanimously off the Republican floor, and two people voted against it on the DFL side, so I did worse than my Republican author. We also last year passed a bill that passed off the House floor individually with broad bipartisan support, a bill that clarified the definition or changed the definition of a gross misdemeanor in Minnesota so that there weren't collateral immigration consequences of a state-level crime, that Minnesota gets to decide what the impact of a crime in Minnesota is, not the federal government. And lastly, I just wanted to lift up the bipartisan work we did around labor trafficking, updating some definitions to protect immigrant construction workers primarily, and that, again, was really bipartisan. So in my time here in the legislature, I've been really gratified that this issue has not been a political football and that we've been able to do meaningful work together. And those bills really represent an understanding that immigrants are not a monolith. They're not all the same, and that they're not just a political tool. They're people who live in our state. And forgive me for getting all immigration lawyer professory, but I just wanted to really mention the fact that our immigration laws are atrophied. That's the word I like to use. We haven't proactively updated them since 1990. The world was really different. Our economy was really different. Technology was different. The workplace was different. And, you know, what we did over time, 1952, 1965, 1990, is we were like, what does America need? What does our healthcare system need? Was our workforce need? Was our economy need? And we updated our laws. And we haven't done that in decades. And, you know, bills like this are going to make life a lot harder for exactly the people that if Congress would do their job, they would promote immigration pathways for these folks. It's low-wage caregivers, in particular in rural areas. A lot of the caregivers for our seniors are undocumented. It's agricultural workers. I forget the exact number, but like 40 to 50% of workers on farms are undocumented. And lastly, in construction industry, it's 20% of our construction industry. Those workers are undocumented, and we need them. And if, you know, we could change federal law to actually create a work visa for these folks, that would be really good. I don't know if that's going to happen. And so I just, you know, I see bills like this and feel that they're based on this sort of erroneous premise that immigrants are inherently problematic for public safety. And so, again, I just really want to focus committee's attention on the materials submitted by the conservative Cato Institute's David Beer, who I'm a fangirl of, I'll admit. But he provides just some good charts and some graphs, just kind of showing that the data is really clear that immigrants, including undocumented immigrants, are not more likely to commit crimes. In fact, they're less likely. And also, he has a really good chart just looking at cities with separation ordinances, like the ones impacted by House File 16, and that cities with large undocumented communities actually saw a decrease in their murder rates, even those that had these separation ordinances. So I just think it's really important to highlight that data. And, you know, I think it's really important to think about what is public safety. And I don't think it is about looking at immigrants as the sort of inherent public safety threat. The real public safety issue is, you know, can people call 911 for help when they need it? And I think that's the work that we try to do here in this committee. And so, again, I appreciated that you really seemed to listen as people sat next to you and shared their thoughts and their expertise. And we have a kind of bizarrely broad coalition of people who have concerns, from the Sheriff's Association to the Minneapolis City Council, and I can't imagine they agree on that many things. And so, you know, I'm opposed to this bill for the reasons that were raised today, and I hope that you will kind of think about the point of this bill and the goals that you have around public safety and maybe reconsider. So thank you.
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, maybe just the one thing I'll say is, in terms of the data that you referenced, Representative, from the Cato Institute, it does create a problem here in Minnesota specifically. Minnesota is an anomaly sometimes, good and bad, and we don't collect data on, you know, potentially how many illegal immigrants are actually committing crimes, what is the crime rate among that specific population. So, you know, even though there might be a trend, just even talking about maybe the total number of potential people who are here who are undocumented, even that data was hard to crawl through and find. So maybe just the one thing I'll say, addressing your broader point, was that we don't have specific data on what you're claiming in Minnesota.
Representative okay. Feist.
I'll be short. And then I did have one just technical question, if that's all right, Mr. Chair.
As long as there's a question. At some
there
point.
Is a question. Just so you know, the chart, and I can give you a copy of the report, it's a ton of cities across the country, big cities, some with separation ordinances, some not. So it's not just Minneapolis data. This is a national study. And then I did have a question about, on the final page of your bill, line 4.6. It talks about the definition of an undocumented person, and I was just curious. So your definition talks about the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. And so I was just wondering, if somebody is on a J-1 visa, which is a Department of State issued visa, and they get a DS-2019 form, which is a Department of State form, and then they get admitted by the Customs and Border Protection and get I-94 record, which is what their status is and when it expires, but they are never seen by USCIS, are they an undocumented person?
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I don't have that information in particular right now, but I'm happy to get that to you after the committee today.
Representative Feist.
They're definitely here legally, and so would investor visas who just come through the Department of State and CBP. F-1 students get documents from ICE and are admitted by CBP. They never have any interaction with USCIS, so I think your definition is excluding or including a lot of people who are here lawfully. Thank you. I'll leave it at that.
Response, Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No.
With that, we'll recess at the call of the chair. The meeting will reconvene. Representative Hollins. Oh, there she is.
Did you call me? Okay, sorry. I was talking. I'm sorry. Sorry, Representative Reimer. Okay, let me wrap my head around where I was. So, we haven't had the pleasure of working together before, but I am a lawyer, and I don't do criminal law, which is kind of unusual, I think, in this committee. So, I don't get a chance to talk a lot about my experience, but what I did want to mention with regards to your bill, I did family law, right? So, custodies, divorce, adoption, all of that stuff. And what I will say is, and what I'm concerned about is, in my experience, people use the lack of documentation for immigrants as a weapon. When a man has a child with a woman who is undocumented, he uses her status as a weapon against her for both domestic violence, for custody battles. Like, you can't go to the courts and ask for custody or ask for visitation, because if you do, I will have you deported. Similarly with financial extortion. So I don't know how much you know about family law, but sometimes you get child support dictated by the courts, but also people can come to agreements on their child support. And when you have people coming to agreements on their child support independent of the court, and one person is undocumented, it means that it can be wildly unfair, because of the risk of deportation, the risk of being sent to ICE. And so when I look at this bill, and I know Representative Engen mentioned that it was only for violent offenders, but I'm looking at Section 2, which is not about violent offenders. It's simply about the state, any city, county official, not working, not allowed to withhold information from ICE. And so this is the situation in which I see this being a real issue, is when people want to go to court to make sure that they have visitation with their child, to make sure that they are paying a fair amount of child support, they're not able to do that anymore. And these are people who work within our system, who pay taxes, who are a part of our community, who are being told you cannot have access to your kids, you can't have access to your money because you are afraid. And somebody is using this to abuse you, whether it's legally or physically. So that's the one thing I wanted to highlight. And I don't know if you have an answer for me, but I'll pause right here to see if you have a response to that.
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. More or less, this would require, and at the federal level, the Trump administration has really talked about prioritizing violent offenders, right? And so what this bill tries to do is come in conjunction with the bipartisan legislation that happened in Congress, the Lake and Riley Act. And what I would just say is, if there is not an active investigation on somebody, then there is no need to cooperate. It's not like the local government units or the family courts or any entity like that is under requirement to proactively proclaim we have an illegal immigrant here. This is talking about coming in accordance and being responsive to a federal government inquiry.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand what you're saying, but the reality is when people bring a case to court, regardless of what that court is, regardless of whether they have a case out on them, they still have to go to the courthouse, right? And they have to state, right, if their spouse says, my spouse is undocumented, or not spouse, I suppose, but it, you know, my partner is undocumented, then that goes into a record. And it is known to the peace officers who stand guard in our court systems. It goes to the judge who is in that court system. It is information about, you know, you say official, employee, you know, criminal justice agency, peace officer, et cetera. There are a lot of people who would have that knowledge that then makes those individuals susceptible to immigration tactics. And so I hear what you're saying, and I think maybe there is a more delicate way to get at this, but as it stands, this bill really has deep concerns about that, and it means that people who are living in our cities, in our state, will not feel comfortable communicating their needs to the government agencies that their tax dollars pay for. The second question that I have is I'm really concerned about healthcare for seniors. So I don't know if you have any seniors in your life, but I had a father-in-law who was diagnosed with ALS when I was in my last year of law school. And we had a whole host of people who provided care to him. And a lot of those people were immigrants. And so knowing that there is such a shortage of that care provided, I'm wondering how this bill anticipates dealing with the fact that there will be fewer people who will want to even participate in our employment sector, right? In a space that is really necessary, right? There was a Star Tribune article that says 17,000 job openings for Minnesota care professionals, and that really relies on immigrant populations. And so I'm wondering how you intend to deal with that, how our elderly and infirmed individuals will deal with not having that necessary care that they rely on every day.
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I would say is, first and foremost, and your question is well heard, and not to make light of it, but don't rape, kill, or murder, or carjack someone, first and foremost. The second thing is, the state is not, in this piece of legislation, a proactive, again, they're not shouting the fact that we have undocumented immigrants who are doing our elder care right now. That would need to be initiated by the federal government. And the federal government, I think up to this point, has made pretty clear what their priorities are in terms of targeting violent offenders. So this bill is in conjunction with accommodating that.
Representative Hollins?
Sure. I just have one follow-up bit. So hearing you on the criminal aspect of it, but I, again, will direct you to Section 2, which is not regarding criminal aspects. That is regarding the cooperation of local law enforcement in whatever way they are, in whatever their capacity is, with ICE. So maybe somebody is just applying for a background check. Maybe somebody is applying to a government agency or trying to get a job that is within, you know, that is supplemented by, you know, Medicare or MinnesotaCare or something like that. If they find out this person is not documented, your bill is saying they must cooperate with ICE. They must report this person. So that doesn't have anything to do with their criminal background. That just has to do with them being a person who is an immigrant who is undocumented, and that's where my concern lies. Thank you.
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Noted and appreciate the comments and questions.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Reimer. One of the things that we see in our line of work, and I think maybe the folks on the law enforcement side do this as well or have done this in the past, but for example, when we started seeing a bunch of overdose deaths in our community.
A bunch of what?
Overdose. Oh. Sorry. Overdose deaths, right? Heroin, it'll come in waves, and we're seeing a huge impact on it. And what our agency did is instead of saying, look, if we come to your house and you have heroin or used heroin, we're going to arrest you. They said, if somebody is having an emergency and you call us, we have Narcan, we are not going to arrest you. Like they know that if the thought is that they are going to get arrested, people won't call. They will try and deal with it on their own. They'll try to find some other thing, and people get hurt because of it. So I know that the Sheriff's Association said they have concerns, and I'm still trying to do my due diligence and read a lot of the information that we get. And concerns generally, it seems like the Minnesota nice way of saying opposed to. It's like the softer way of being opposed to something. And so just for the record, what the Sheriff's Association said is House File 16 raises several legal concerns, particularly as it relates to due process and equal protection. In addition, the broad reporting requirements increase the risk of civil rights violations and may expose counties to lawsuits with costs having to be covered by property taxes and levies. These legal concerns are more detailed in an accompanying Minnesota County Attorneys Association letter. Lastly, mandatory reporting of arrests, regardless of prosecution decisions, may discourage immigrant communities from reporting crimes or cooperating with law enforcement, ultimately undermining public safety. So, how do you respond to those concerns from the Sheriff's Association in how this is going to impact their ability to do their jobs in the communities that they serve?
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. And I don't know every letter that you got in there, but there are a number of those groups that I've had conversations with and talked through the concerns. In regards to the 14th Amendment and making sure that you have due process, which all people are guaranteed, whether or not you are documented or undocumented in the country, this ICE, federal authorities, are still beholden to the 14th Amendment. That new burden is not placed on our local law enforcement because that respect is still maintained at the federal level. ICE is still beholden to the 14th Amendment and individual rights. And to the extent that people would be scared to report crimes and things of that nature, I think the two things to keep in mind is this would be, ICE would need a reason, you know, The Trump administration, federal government, has said they are prioritizing violent criminals, offenders, drug dealers, etc. They would need a reason to open up an investigation. And on the side of this bill, which talks about our law enforcement reporting that crime, there is a very narrow set of crimes that need to be suspected of in order to be reported. What I would just caution, what I would just say, and I think you know, I don't mind being called this or that, but I think our rhetoric also has something to do with this as well. Should this bill become law, it's making sure that we try to keep the narrow focus in our rhetoric and how we talk about this, because we had a bunch of really talented, articulate testifiers come up here and give me personally a lot to think about, frankly. But what I also heard was a lot of things that were straying, I think, outside the purview of this particular bill. The conflation of legal and illegal immigrants, their contributions to society, and I get why that might have some broader context, but I also think the way that we talk about legislation like this, I'm always open to feedback, but I think that plays into some of your concerns.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick follow-up comment. A lot of folks that are in those marginalized communities are fearful as it is, and this adds another layer that will impact their willingness to call and ask for help, which means that more people in our communities, regardless of their status, are going to be suffering and potentially being put in more harm's way than if this bill becomes law. So it is a reality. It's something that we deal with all the time. We have to be trusted as firefighters, as EMTs, as law enforcement. You have to be trusted by the community that you serve. And this runs contrary to the ability to form and maintain that trust in those relationships. And I'll leave it at that.
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nothing.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Reimer, for bringing this. One thing you'll learn, it was something I had to come to terms with, is sometimes in this work we think we're doing a really good thing, and it ends up having unintended consequences. And it's okay that that happens, and it's okay to go back to work on it and make it better. My concern with this bill, and we heard a number of testifiers talk about it, we have a number of letters here, is how this impacts victims. And Representative Johnson talked about the trust that is needed within the community for law enforcement to ask for help, and that's one piece of it. And I don't know if you all recall, this was a couple of years ago, there was a woman on a construction site, and we've heard today about the human trafficking that happens within labor and the construction industry. What goes along with that is oftentimes sexual assault. So there was a woman who worked on a construction site, I think it was in St. Paul, who was raped on the job site. She was there to clean bathrooms and apartment buildings as they were being worked on, and she was raped in a bathtub in an apartment building. And she worked with the Carpenters Union and law enforcement to come forward and to talk about it. And I remember hearing her story that there was a event held on the Capitol steps where she stood there and told her story as an undocumented woman who was raped on the job site. That took an immense amount of trust that she wasn't going to face further consequences after going through this horrific assault. And just on March 3rd, they held a press conference. Attorney General Keith Ellison prosecuted Absolute Drywall because she trusted that she wasn't going to get deported, bringing to light what had happened to her. And that's one woman and one chance that we got to get it right. And we know that the labor brokers, that is what they hold over the head of their workers. First of all, they create that fear. They threaten, well, I'll go to law enforcement, I'll get you deported. The labor brokers know they're not going to go in law enforcement to face those consequences themselves, but they instill that fear to people that are new to the country, that are trying to send money home, that are trying to be an honest worker, right? And it can go in a lot of really terrible directions. And so the fact that this woman had the courage to bring her story forward is the exact reason a bill like this can be so damaging, and why you don't see story after story after story in the news, but I promise you it's happening. And I wish the woman that testified, I believe Ms. Lohman or something from one of our testifiers, was here to kind of expand upon it, because I just know this of this story through my work here. And I think that we don't need to rush into matching federal policy. We don't need to rush something like this, because the unintended consequences here can be really bad for a lot of the work that we're trying to do to bring to light the criminals that are doing this on the job sites. And that's just one piece of it. We heard victims talk about domestic violence, and there's no doubt your testifier story is horrific. And we need to address something like that. But that's not the only story out there. That's not the only person affected. We're talking about entire communities. And so I just want to bring that to light, because we do have concrete stories of what good can happen when terrible things happen to people, but it's only if they can trust that they're not going to face worse or additional consequences when coming forward to shed light on really bad actors. And so once again, there is no shame in slowing it down, working on it a little, making sure that we're getting at what we want without impacting entire communities in ways that we may never regain the trust that they place in us. So no question, I just kind of wanted to give you an example of some of the things that we're trying not to do when we rush into legislation like this. Thank you.
Representative Reimer, response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing I'll say is that I think we'll learn together, Representative Berg, the importance of balance, because it's the first time in this chamber that we've had balance since you were elected. There's a balance between the stories that you lay out and then the stories that we are presented with real victims that cause marginalized communities in particular when you have a situation, a compounding situation, of an undocumented immigrant. So we can all agree that if you're undocumented, it means that you came here without our knowledge, right? So there's that situation. And then that's compounded in what this bill is trying to address with the fact that you have committed a violent or heinous offense. Marginalized communities are as impacted by that. And for every story that you have talked about that doesn't make a headline, there is likely a story like America Thayer's story, or like the story where I think it was a year ago, where in Fridley, you know, an undocumented illegal immigrant posed as a UPS driver and murdered a family of three. Those are headlines, and he had committed, you know, he had been convicted of other crimes in the past, and we kept him here. Now, there, for every situation that you describe, there's a situation that I describe. And I'm happy as this thing works its way through. I'm happy to continue talking about it, but what I would just say is I think this addresses a real problem that actually disproportionately impacts marginalized communities when you keep a violent offender who doesn't need to be here or who shouldn't be here in the community. So that's what I'll say on that. Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Reimer. I appreciate that you view this as a bill that protects victim survivors of violent crimes. I'll note that the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault disagrees with you. Violence Free Minnesota disagrees with you. The organizations that actually work with victim survivors feel that you're wrong. They disagree with you about this bill. I've worked for many years as a prosecutor specializing in gender violence. I actually was the charged the case. I'm a co-chair of the case that sent longest case for sex trafficking sentence for that crime in Minnesota history. So I think I know what I say when I'm talking about these issues. And where I just recognize this is an interesting bill, because when you've got those victim survivor groups standing with our school boards associations and our League of Minnesota Cities and our Associated Minnesota Counties and county attorneys, League of Minnesota Cities, heck, the Cato Institute, we've got the Sheriff's Association expressing significant concerns. It's just you brought a lot of groups out who all disagree with you. And I recognize that you've got your view, but those folks or professionals have a different view. And so one thing that confused me in what you're saying, you keep on referencing the fact that this is limited to people who've committed violent crimes. Can you just explain where that is in your bill? Because I'm confused about that. Because you were very clear that the only way somebody gets pulled into this is if they're a rapist or a murderer. Can you just point that out to me?
Yeah, so the bill references Minnesota statute.
Representative Reimer.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Yeah, the bill represents or references violent crime as defined by Minnesota State Statute 624-172, Subdivision 5.
Oh, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so, Representative Reimer, that confuses me. So first, that's only in Section 3 of the bill, so Sections 1 and 2 are a lot broader. But even setting that aside, I mean, you brought this bill to us. You're spending a lot of time, and you seem very confident about your protecting a victim. So you would know that including a crime of violence is somebody who possesses a tiny amount of methamphetamine. That's it. That is a crime of violence under felony crime of violence under 624.712 subdivision 5. So is that a group that you do want included in your bill in section 3, is that right? And many other crimes as well, but it includes all drug crimes under chapter 152. I'm assuming that you know that since you're bringing this to us. And that's a group that you want included in your section 3 of your bill?
Representative Reimer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If they're dealing methamphetamine, then yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Reimer, no, it's drug possession. And so let's actually, and again, there's a lot of problems with 1 and 2, but let's just go to Section 3. And if you have it in front of you, yeah, please do. And if folks can do that, go to line 3.22. Because just this one sentence from 3.22 to 3.24, it's a pretty simple sentence. But I think if we just unpack it, we will see just one aspect of how this bill does not make any sense. So when a peace officer arrests an undocumented person on suspicion of committing a crime of violence, we talked about what that is, county attorney has to report the person to ICE. So let's just pause for a second. We've got a lot of law enforcement officers, former around the table. So peace officer stops, does a traffic stop, common situation, discovers a dime bag. There's some drugs in the bag, right? And they make an arrest, person sitting in the squad car. So under your bill, what happens next? Oh, and sorry, let's say this too. In the squad car, and the county attorney, and let's say, by the way, the case is not presented for charging. Actually, let's just make this real simple. They figure out a little while later that the stuff in the bag is sugar, not drugs. Person was arrested, though. Person was arrested. So explain to me sort of what the steps are about how this works at that point. Because I want to point out, there's no discretion here. An arrest happened. So the county attorney has to report an undocumented person. I didn't say the person's undocumented, mind you. I didn't say they're documented. We got a peace officer who's like responding to, you know, crimes, right? They're doing their job. They got to run off to the next call and next call and next call. So how does this work? Can you just explain to me how that happens? After the arrest, turns out to be sugar, they're going to release the person, but now an arrest was made. Walk us through how that works. And by the way, the county attorney wouldn't have known any of this, but in your bill now, suddenly the county attorney has to get involved. Walk us through how that works practically.
Representative Pinto, have you ever charged out a case where there wasn't a preliminary test of a NIC test?
Mr. Chair, we can play
whatabouts and things, but I really don't know at least in my experience, anyone being charged with a felony and being making a custodial arrest when there wasn't a preliminary roadside test done. So, I'll go to the question, but I mean, it's just getting outrageous. Representative Reimer.
Mr. Chair, yeah, and it seems like Representative Pinto might have specific words for you, too. But one thing I just want to say, and of note, it's been really interesting to hear some of what you're saying, a little bit of the testimony. We're increasingly getting into hypothetical situations that seem more and more outlandish is the way that I'll phrase it. This is a very practical bill, in my opinion, that outlines specifically the crimes that must be committed and cooperating with and bringing up. People kept saying, you know, clouding, bringing us into accordance with the federal government so that we are working as a cohesive unit to get violent offenders out of our city or out of our communities. So, I can't address your particular hypothetical because it's just that. We're talking about a lot of situational victims, a lot of hypothetical victims, but there are real victims that we have stories of and that are many go unreported by people who are being kept here when they shouldn't be.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair and Representative Reimer. This bill, I will say, Mr. Chair and Representative Reimer, there are many, many cases that do not make it to me as a prosecutor because what happens is the arrest is made, the person is brought back, at least in St. Paul, actually, I guess in all the jurisdictions I work in, there is a NIC test that's done not at the scene, I guess with the troopers, actually the troopers probably not either. The NIC test is done later, right? So an arrest happens, there's a test that's done, and I certainly have cases where the test is done and it turns out that it's inconclusive. It can't be shown that that's what the drug is, and the person gets released. This bill, look at line 3.22, is where there's a suspicion of committing a crime of violence. Suspicion. That's all that there is. The case never makes it to the county attorney. But under your bill, the county attorney has to be informed. This is the reason that our state's county attorneys have come out in firm opposition. They aren't just concerned. They are opposed to the bill. There's a reason that they are saying that. And in fact, it's a suspicion that says all that is required. I want to point out, Representative Reimer, I'd like your response to this, because this hadn't occurred to me at first. I looked at it and realized, absolutely, the letter from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office pointing out that violent offenders will, in fact, use this as a weapon. There's been a general reference to this by other colleagues in their questions to you. But I think specifically, if you're on trial, right, in fact, for rape or murder, you just happen to be documented, you happen to be a U.S. citizen, and what you decide to do is, your victim is undocumented. Well, of course you're gonna say that they got drugs on them. Maybe you'll even plant something on them. Boom, off they go. So that's a piece of it being people being less safe. So explain how Section 3, and we're only talking about Section 3, not the other problems. How would Section 3 not be used as a weapon in the manner that is described by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office?
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Chair. Again, Representative, I think we're getting into a lot of different hypothetical situations. I don't know how to specifically address what you have just laid out step by step and how that would specifically work out. But I do find that we're escalating in terms of the hypothetical situational things that we're laying out for what I believe is a pretty simple bill.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Reimer, like, welcome to criminal law. Like, this is how it is. I can tell you I've tried many violent people in trials, gotten them convicted, had some times that I didn't. I went at it really hard on behalf of victim survivors. Like, these are real situations. And I can tell you in my outside job as a prosecutor, I'm seeing body cameras, I'm reading reports. Like, this is actual stuff. This is not, you know, fancy in the cloud stuff. This is actual stuff in terms of how this will work. There is a reason the county attorneys have come out against this. There's a reason that the sheriff has expressed concern and all the other concerns. And I guess, Chair, let me just ask this. How would this impact T and U visas, if I can ask that? And what would be the interaction between this and T and U visas for those victims of crimes?
Representative Reimer.
Did you, Mr. Chair? Thank you. So TNU visas, I'm not in particularly sure. One thing I just wanted to take this moment to address, because I think it might also answer Representative Feist's question from before, was I did try to do a little bit of rapid research over the last hour to just try to address maybe what you brought up, and maybe this is covered under TUV visas as well. But the language of acquiescences is also found in 256L.04 subdivision 10. So that kind of defines acquiescences. I'm not sure if this this specifically represents your issue either. So,
and Chair, I'm not sure what
acquiescence.
I'm not sure what acquiescence is, what Representative Reimer is referring to. My apologies. I may have, was an earlier question or something. I don't recall the word acquiescence is.
Yep.
Which doesn't seem like a word, actually, but maybe it is. Can you maybe explain, maybe Representative Reimer, Mr. Chair, can just explain what he's referencing and also just answer the, what sounds like you said you're not familiar with TNU visas. Page 4.7, my colleagues are pointing out. That may be something for Representative Feist, may be able to provide some expertise if she's
actually
able, Mr. Chair.
Actually, Representative Pinto, if you could, I know you're getting very passionate here, but if you could just slow down a little bit, because it sounded to me like a couple of minutes ago you said that cops are planting evidence on people.
No, not at all.
Okay, if you could just slow down. I know
absolutely,
you're passionate.
Mr. Chair,
this is
absolutely
something
not.
That you're highly involved in, but.
No, I was talking about abusers, Mr. Chair. People who are in the middle of a felony trial that an abuser would do this against their victim. Absolutely not saying that about our law enforcement officers. Okay. I'm talking about abusers, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to make sure that's clear.
Hard to keep up.
Sorry, and I'm
a fast
talker, Mr. Chair. My
thank
apologies.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. Maybe I think Representative Feist may be able to clarify this issue about the visas and the acquiescence, if that's okay, Chair.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I promise I'll keep it short. And so that doesn't address my concern. So the issue is that immigration law is administered by numerous agencies that play different roles for different types of lawful non-immigrant visas. And so many, many people can be present in the United States legally, but have never filed anything with the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. And I think Representative Pinto's question about U and T visas relates to the fact that immigrant victims of crimes can go to law enforcement under federal law, and if the law enforcement agrees with them that they have collaborated in the investigation or prosecution of that crime, they can give them a document called a U or a T visa certification. And just to take a step back, U visas are for immigrant victims of serious crimes that are enumerated under federal law, and T visas are for victims of trafficking. And so as part of that process, they can then get legal immigration status. And the point of the U and the T visa being created was to encourage immigrant victims of crimes and immigrant witnesses to crimes to collaborate with law enforcement and to seek help. And so I think the concern is that U and T
visa eligible immigrants are not going to feel like they are safe to seek that help to serve as a witness. And we're just curious, you know, what guarantees are immigrants going to have about the privacy of that data?
And Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I'll be wrapping up. It sounds like there was a question from Representative Feist or Representative Reimer, but then I'll have just a final comment.
That question, or it seemed like an extension of your question, right?
Representative, hold on.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I was asking if Representative Reimer, it sounds like he wants to answer Representative Feist's question. I was going to step back from that, and then I'll just have one final piece, and then I'll be done, Mr. Chair.
Representative Reimer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you both for the tag team question, I think. This bill doesn't specifically address that, take anything away from that, et cetera.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then wrapping up, I think, Representative Reimer, the concern is that those groups that work with victim survivors, not just the ones I mentioned before, Advocates Human Rights, The Link, these are groups that I've worked with closely in anti-trafficking work, and there is a deep concern that they express and that I share on behalf of victim survivors of human trafficking and of sexual violence and of violent crimes. It's ironic that the bill is being brought forward purportedly on behalf of people experiencing those crimes, and yet in fact, people who work closely with those folks saying, no, it's just the opposite. And so I guess just this final point I want to make is that the bill is in fact so much broader than been referenced. I was focused on Section 3, but noting that those other sections apply to all undocumented immigrants. They apply, Section 2, as I read it, applies not just to public safety officials, it's any public employees. It applies to schools. It applies to any kind of public services of any kind, adding to the fear and the concern expressed by all these different groups. And I guess you had said, well, the Trump administration is focused on violent criminals. The president has made very clear repeatedly, right, his intent to deport all undocumented immigrants. This was something that was a strong campaign plank, right? The largest deportation in our country's history. So I don't think that it would be a good idea for any of us to not take the president's words seriously when he says that in fact that is the goal. And so I don't think we should be reading your bill as, oh, it's just aimed at this particular group. The federal government has made very clear it's everybody. That's what they're saying. And if you think that this bill is a good idea for everybody, then I guess I would ask you to please be upfront and honest about that actually being what the situation is, because based on what President Trump wants to do, that is what your bill would be involved in. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Chair. Nothing further.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Reimer, I think you've repeated a few times, and just sort of picking up where Representative Pinto left off, but that the Trump administration's priorities right now that he's articulating are going after violent criminals. Would you be advancing this bill if the Trump administration's immigration policy priorities were broader and were just targeting all immigrants for mass deportation?
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, this bill was really born out of the Lake and Riley Act, again, which got bipartisan support in Congress. You know, the November election was in large part adjudicated because people really cared about the strength of our border and making sure that we are actually taking seriously immigration. We did have one testifier who talked about Mr. Thayer's situation, who seemed very legally astute, but talked about how this was a perfect storm to create this victim. But what I worry about is how many perfect storms are occurring in our currently broken system. This bill, and I can only control my bill, the decision that I've made with this bill, is to focus on violent offenders and bring us in accordance with should federal immigration authorities see a reason that a violent offender is in our community, we should have law enforcement, local law enforcement, cooperating with them. That's all I can say.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Chair Navani. I didn't hear an answer. And I guess here's why it matters. There's a 10th Amendment principle called commandeering that says the federal government can't commandeer state resources, local resources, to do their work like local law enforcement. We have that constitutional principle. And my concern with this bill, especially tacking it to frankly any policy position of the president, particularly one that seems to shift all the time, but any policy position, whether you support that president or not, is that what this bill does is commandeer to a certain degree and say that state and local resources will be facilitating that federal policy, regardless of who that president is. And so it really matters, the question I asked, which is, would you still be advancing this bill if the policy that you have articulated, again, and focused a lot on violent crime, which I want to talk about because we've talked about helping and ensuring violence, that we are keeping our community safe. My city came up, and I want to get to that in a second. But before we get there, I just want to be really clear that if you are hanging this on the idea that the current president has said their immigration policy priorities are violent criminals, that could change in a minute, and the commandeering won't change. And so I guess I'd ask again, and maybe I'll ask it a different way so I can get a yes or no answer, but would you be advancing this bill if the president of any administration had a policy that was targeting all immigrants for deportation?
Representative Reimer, would you like to respond to the same question again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I can say is that this bill targets violent offenders. That is what this bill is designed to do. Again, it has been my understanding that both the Lake and Riley Act and what the Trump administration has said thus far is that they are prioritizing drugs pouring across our border, violent offenders, and making sure that our communities are safe. I can't answer a bunch of hypotheticals that keep getting brought up in this committee.
Representative Greenman, do you have a different question?
Thank you. I do. Thank you, Chair Novotny. And that's our job here, is to govern, not just for the seven anecdotes that we bring, but our job is to pass laws that affect the general public. In this case, we are passing a law that will say that state and local resources will go to implement federal policy. And so today, that may be one thing. Tomorrow, it'll be another. But as you said, this bill and all you can control is my bill. But this bill doesn't hold on to control for those policy priorities in the state. It gives those policy priorities over to federal decision makers. And that's a concern for me here in Minnesota. I guess the second question I'd have is, in addition to the state federal question, there is a state-local question. And we hear a lot in other committees, and I know you're new to the legislature, but I will say I have heard a lot in my 4 years here about local control, about mandates, about one-size-fits-all. And to me, that's what this bill does. It's preemption, but it creates a mandate that eliminates local control, has a one-size-fits-all, and says Minneapolis and Waconia, I'm just sort of the first thing that comes to me at the end of the alphabet, have to have this, that their law enforcement have to have the same set of policies and priorities, which are set to a certain degree by the federal government. And so I guess my question on local control is, you know, we have, and I won't bore you with, I pulled up the Minnesota House Research state-local relations, but our policy, you know, the Dillon's Rule and all the things that modify it. But we do have, the way that we have structured our laws is to have a broad grant of authority from the state to locals to exercise, and I quote, any power not enumerated specifically to contribute to the protection of health, morals, peace, other good order of community, to promote welfare and trade, commerce, manufacturing, et cetera, et cetera. And we have always known in this committee, we hear a lot from local law enforcement, from sheriffs, from police departments, from public safety commissioners about the individual needs of those localities. And I'm wondering if you think that the policy priorities of Minneapolis and the policy priorities of Minnesota should be the same as mandated by state law.
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In earnest, I'm not sure that I could you ask the question a different way. I'm not sure that I understand the question.
I can ask
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. I can ask it a different way. I guess I'm asking why you think local communities that have different challenges, different priorities under this bill that creates a one-size-fits-all approach to the relationship with federal priorities. I'm wondering why you think that that is an appropriate way for the state to govern so that Minneapolis and Minnesota, and I'm just picking two, my state and another state that sounds like it, why you think that those two local jurisdictions should be treated the same under this bill.
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I think the biggest reason is because we have had a number of local officials openly talk about defying federal orders. And I would just say as a deterrent to violent crime, to emboldening criminals, a deterrent would not be saying that we are going to not work with federal immigration authorities at all. And yet, we have a number of local politicians who are more than happy to use a political megaphone in order to amplify that message. I think this bill in particular helps send the message that we're going to keep communities safe. There's going to be a standard operating process for how we do this, and there's a very narrow focus on the crimes committed, that if you commit this crime, there should be the threat of us taking you out of here.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I heard law enforcement officers, I heard my public safety commissioner, I heard and see the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, talk about the challenges as it relates to deterrence. You talked about deterrence. And what we know is the best deterrence is apprehension when we're talking about crimes. And what this does is say, instead of focusing on apprehending, charging, and prosecuting, what is going to happen to our local law enforcement, and I have heard today, our local law enforcement, and I know other folks have said this, their law enforcement priorities, their apprehension priorities, their prosecution priorities with county attorneys are in service now of the civil act of ICE of our immigration system. To me, that's not deterrence, that's not public safety. To me, that is, you said political megaphone, you talked about turning down the rhetoric. To me, you just said send a message. I think that this is not sending a message about public safety. I heard victims and prosecutors and folks say this is actually going to make it harder for victims to report and coordinate with law enforcement. I heard law enforcement say that this is going to make it harder because we're going to lose trust with folks in community. I heard almost every one of these letters raise concerns about that. And so what it feels like to me is not about keeping the residents of Minneapolis safe, the residents in Minnesota safe, thinking about violence prevention, thinking about how we fund after school care, all of those things that we spend the rest of this committee talking about. This feels like what it is it's about scapegoating communities, and it is about waving a political issue in front of our face. And so I hope that as we move forward, we talk about deterrence and apprehension. I hope as we move forward, we talk about things that we know are proven solutions. This is not one of them. The testimonies, including the Sheriff's Association, say it isn't. This creates a divide between communities and each other, but also communities and law enforcement, which is not going to keep my communities or all of our communities safe. And for that, I mean, this is a bill I'm looking forward to voting against. Thank you.
Response, Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Greenman, for your feedback.
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to highlight a couple concerns I have with this bill. I'm hearing from a number of members of my community that there's a real heightened sense of fear about bills like this. Parents are unable to take their kids to school now because they're afraid that they might get arrested, imprisoned, deported. I know what happened in Worthington a number of years ago really devastated the immigrant community down there. I have family members who are teachers down there, and they talked about how students left home, said goodbye to their parents, and they came back home, and their parents weren't home. They had been deported, or arrested at least. And so this is a real concern that I have is, you know, our children's well-being, education for our children, and just this heightened fear that people will have that, you know, anything they do could lead to an arrest and imprisonment, deportation. So that's one of my big concerns. Another concern I have is, you know, the economy in Minnesota. You know, we're dealing with a lot of uncertainties. You know, a lot is coming from the federal government with the tariffs that will raise prices. The stock market is plunging. And I know even, you know, years ago we talked about how, you know, if we don't have an immigrant population working in the health sector, in the agricultural sector, we're really going to be hurting. And so David Beer, who's, you know, part of the conservative Cato Institute, he testified before Congress that losing undocumented immigrants would crash local economies, create a death spiral of lost consumers, closed businesses, and declining tax revenue. Also, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, they wrote something similar. They talked about the importance of immigration to Minnesota safety and well-being. And this is data from 2020, which is a few years ago, but it said immigrant households in the state paid $4.5 billion in taxes in 2019, $2 billion in state and local taxes, and $2.5 billion in federal taxes. These tax dollars help support public education, health care, and safety throughout the community. And I guess in 2023, those state taxes paid were up to $6.2 billion, so it's probably even more in 2025. So another article in the Star Tribune by Sean O'Neill with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce on March 7th wrote, "The bottom line is clear. Immigration is not just a demographic trend. It's a powerful economic strategy. Minnesota's future, competitiveness, and innovation depend on it." So I guess mostly comments. I don't know if you want to respond, but I am concerned about this bill. I don't think it addresses the horrific murder that happened in Shakopee. You know, I think we need to address domestic violence, certainly. I think that's something I'd love to, you know, focus on in this committee. But I am concerned about this bill and how it would affect the well-being and just the general overall feeling of safety in our communities.
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative. I'd love to work with you on a future bill like that. So thank you for your comments.
Follow up, Representative Reim.
No.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Reimer, for presenting this bill. I almost forgot what it was and what it does, because we've been talking about a lot of things that go well outside the scope of it. So just to reset the conversation, it's got three sections. Section one says that a government entity will provide information. Am I looking at the right? There we go. Sorry about that. Let me collect myself here for a second. This is the impact of the expansive conversation that we've been having. Notwithstanding state or local, no government entity responsible authority within Minnesota may prohibit or in any way an official from receiving or transmitting federal immigration agency data. So we're saying we're not going to prohibit the transmission of this data. Section 2 says that we're not going to allow government entities, local government entities, to specifically prohibit the ability of law enforcement to cooperate. Not saying we're mandating it. We're saying you can't prohibit it. And then Section 3, which was conflated with commandeering, merely says that the county attorney, in the event of arrest, is going to convey that information to ICE. Commandeering would be if we put this in the U.S. code, right? It would be the United States telling Minnesota what Minnesota subdivisions are going to do. That's not what this bill does. This is the Minnesota House of Representatives. We are deciding what our statute is going to be. There's been a lot of conversation today about community trust. When your first action on our soil is to violate our laws, to violate our sovereignty, to dismiss our ability to control our own country, our own borders, that's a violation of community trust. It's not a good basis upon which to build trust between people. And when you use that illegitimately acquired access to our residents in order to violate their rights, in order to commit crimes against them, violent crimes, that doesn't do very well towards building community trust. The issue here is not, the tension that's being caused in our communities is not as a result of us bringing this bill forward, of Representative Reimer bringing this bill forward to try to get violent criminals properly adjudicated through the immigration system and deported. The problem is that we have endured the violation of our laws, the violation of our sovereignty, to the tune of millions and millions of people. And we haven't enforced our laws. That's the source of this problem. 83% of U.S. adults favor deporting violent criminal aliens. 83%. Now, that's bipartisan. Perhaps not among elected officials. You know, maybe the vast majority of nonprofits, service organizations, the type of people who come to testify in our committee hearings, they might not be part of that 83%. But the real American people are. They support this. They want us to protect our citizens. And when you've already violated our trust by breaking our immigration laws, and then you violate it again by committing a violent crime, I don't want you to feel safe when you've done those things. This idea that keeps being floated, that you have some sort of right to feel safe after violating our sovereignty, violating our laws. No, I have a right to feel safe as a citizen of this country who isn't breaking the law. So does my neighbor. So do legal immigrants who've done it the right way and have gone through our process and abided by our laws. They have a right to feel safe from you. That's what this bill accomplishes, and I appreciate you for bringing it.
Lead Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, when that started, I thought you were talking about colonization and how colonizers came and took lands from Native people. So I got thrown off for a minute by the beginning of that. I'll just say that undocumented folks include people who come to the border and claim asylum. That is legal under our immigration laws. So those are people who came, went to the border, claimed asylum, and then because our federal system takes so long and is messed up, maybe haven't had their hearings yet on that. But those people are considered undocumented for purposes of this bill. And what you're saying is that somehow that is horrible and illegal that they're coming here. So just want to make that clear. As has been said before with the tragic story that we heard about America, the woman who was tragically murdered, as we heard, this bill would not have changed that because that murderer was already on ICE's radar and he couldn't be deported to Cuba because they wouldn't take him back. And so again, that's a federal issue and maybe that did create a perfect storm, but that's not one you're solving with your bill here. I can also tell you, in all my years as a prosecutor, over 20 years now, I have prosecuted far more citizens than non-citizens for violent crimes. I think you had made a comment that said for every citizen that commits a crime, you're going to find a newspaper story about someone undocumented committing a crime. That's not true. It's not my experience as the prosecutor, both in Hennepin County and at the Attorney General's office representing counties in greater Minnesota. I think it's Representative Pinto's experience as well in Ramsey County. But it's also what the data tells us. As has been cited in this Cato Institute studies, it said illegal immigrants reduce crime rates by committing fewer crimes. More than a dozen studies have found that immigration, including illegal immigration, is associated with less crime. And in fact, illegal immigrants help solve crimes. More crimes will go unsolved if we eliminate incentives for these individuals to cooperate with law enforcement, such as U visas, or punish jurisdictions that prioritize community trust. I also heard, and I wasn't quite sure what you were referencing when you said there was a lot of rhetoric here, and I think you were talking about people coming and testifying about how this bill really does have a negative impact on their lives or the lives of the people that they are working with. What I'm thinking about when I hear rhetoric on immigration is what the President of the United States has said. They're eating the cats. They're eating the dogs. That's rhetoric. That's untrue, and it's also harmed people as a result. He also talks frequently about people coming over from insane asylums. I think he's actually confused about what asylum is when you come here and claim asylum as an immigrant. So that's the rhetoric that I'm concerned about, and that's the rhetoric that actually means news reports every time, you know, there's an undocumented person that commits a violent crime. That gets reported. It gets reported probably a lot more frequently on the news than the crimes that citizens are committing. You had also indicated you hadn't read all the letters yet. I know a lot of them came in last night. There are a lot there. By my count, there are 28 letters that are posed or have concerns. Many of those letters have multiple organizations signing on. I saw only one letter of support for your bill. I'll note there was also an article from the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation is the architect of Project 2025, which says it wants to remove U and T visas for victims of crime. So it's more than just what the president has said or what you believe he said about only going after violent offenders, which actually we also know is not true. There's data from ICE that there are now 16% more people with no criminal charges who are being detained right now. So they are increasing people who haven't even, don't have any criminal charges. There was a Star Tribune article about a man from Burnsville who was detained by, I think it was the Bloomington Police Department. He was pulled over driving after suspension, and it said in the article he had no criminal history. That man ended up in Houston. That's what that article was about. So I think that this bill is not ready. I think all of the experts who have come and testified and who have provided letters give all of the reasons why this bill is not ready, and I'm going to be voting no.
Representative Reimer, I'll just get my little closing, and then you can have your say. When we talk about rhetoric, we talk about the rhetoric that's coming from inside this committee, talking about nursing assistants and home care people, having a little bit of experience and working, spending a lot of time with someone that is in the care assist area. Do you have any idea how long it takes to get trained, certified, background checked? I don't think they're really who we're talking about here. You can, once again, we're going to go back to the sky is falling thing. That's not who we're talking about with this bill. This bill is a bill about making a law that says the laws have to be followed. It's just, we're not against and we're not looking for legal immigrants. They are not involved in this. They're the people that I welcome. I'm involved with someone. Okay, my wife works for a nursing organization. There's a statewide effort to recruit nurses from Kenya. Representative Knorr from your party is leading this effort to bring in legal people that are going to provide this care for my parents. Maybe they'll be there when I'm in the nursing home someday. This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about people. You say they got here and they claimed asylum. It goes to what Representative Hudson said about they got here They claimed asylum, so they're good until they're hearing sometime 20 years from now because the courts are so flooded, and then they commit this crime of violence. They had their asylum status. Had they not committed this crime of violence, then they wouldn't be in the situation that they're in. It's a bill to make people follow the law. And I just want to point out, since we're naming our, you know, presidential administration that you want, I was working the night of September 11th, 2001. I was the supervisor for the county, and I watched the black Suburbans take Musawi out of our jail. He was part of the conspiracy. He would have been one of the people that would have been on a plane. I saw him go. Sherman County has become one of the main federal holding facilities. So I've seen and watched. I was in the jail working a lot with them during the Obama administration. And I Googled, because I had plenty of time during some of these questioning streams, how many people were deported? 2.5 million people were deported in the Obama administration. And those were all people that did things to bring attention to themselves. And you talked about due process. We had people that were, yeah, we had one high profile case that was one of the biggest kiddie porn dealers that there was, and he still had his due process before he was deported. This is a bill that just says we should follow the law. None of this other stuff. Not about who you get your shots from. Representative Reimer, close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just keep it very brief. I want to just go back to our original introduction. This bill accomplishes two main things. The first is that it mandates any illegal immigrant arrested on suspicion of a violent crime, even in cases when the county attorney elects not to prosecute, be reported to ICE. Second, this bill prevents state and local entities from actively prohibiting, restricting, or interfering with federal immigration authorities in carrying out federal immigration enforcement. A lot of information. Y'all are really good at what you do. My brain is spinning. The testifiers were really good, and I appreciate the questions, the feedback. I look forward to working with you all. I work both sides of the aisle on future issues. But what I will just say is that I feel like I heard a lot of, again, hypothetical situations which grew in complexity and outlandishness. And I understand that's a consideration, but this bill is very simple, and it goes back to keeping our communities safe. I ask for your yes vote today. Thank you.
I will renew my motion to recommend.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yeah. We'd request a roll call. Thank you.
Renew my motion to recommend that House File 16 is re-referred to the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee. A roll call has been called, and it will be granted. The clerk will take the roll.
Novotny?
Yes.
Witte?
Yes.
Mueller?
No.
Berg?
No.
Bliss?
Yes.
Curran?
No.
Duren?
Yes.
Engen?
Yes.
Feist?
No.
Greenman?
No.
Harder?
Yes.
Hollins?
No.
Hudson?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Pinto?
No.
Ream?
No.
Rapinski?
Yes.
Schwartz?
Yes.
Steer?
Yes.
With 10 ayes and 9 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 16 is re-referred to Elections and Government Operations. Thank you, Representative Reimer. Our next committee meeting will be on Tuesday, March 18th at 3 p.m. There being no further business before the committee today, this meeting is adjourned.